anecdote, which will give people 30 more seconds to get here. There's this old expression, eat a live frog first thing every morning, and that way you know nothing worse will happen to you all day long. Today, instead of eating a live frog, I shattered my coffee pot into like a million pieces, like my glass got like all over my kitchen. And I thought, well, the day will only get better. And I suppose it has.
We'll keep it that way.
Yeah, it can't get worse. So if you're going to try to make my day worse than it started, you're going to have to do worse than shattering a coffee pot. We've already noticed that for the first time in the class, and I'm a little surprised it's the first time, I forgot to change the footer on my slides. So there are plenty of new slides, but they all say April 18th. That's okay. That was a week ago. We have basically two things to do today. It's not really two things, but two things that go on this title slide. The first is continuations, which I'll be honest right now is, in my opinion, by far the most sophisticated, complicated thing in the class. But we'll make a run at it, and it's very cool. I don't want to skip it because it's just too cool. And then we'll start what'll take probably a full 2 weeks, and so it'll go into 2 weeks from now, which is our investigation of types and type systems. So we'll get there in a little while. All right. So to remind you, and this is what I had up while people were coming in, this was our lambda calculus. This was our formal language that we were using to investigate everything and anything that had to do with functions. So this was the definition of our syntax, and this was the definition of our semantics. And this was a large step semantics, so our judgment had the form E goes to value. And because we started with such a tiny, tiny language, we only needed two rules, so that's a little unrealistic, but it's the only two we needed. We needed a rule that say values are already done, and we needed a rule that say the only other thing you could possibly do is apply a function. And if you have something that's syntactically an application, you better recursively come up with two values. The first one better itself be a lambda. That's a bit redundant because in this language, every value is a lambda. And then the overall result V is the result of doing the substitution. Okay? So that's your refresher. That took us, because we had to introduce all this new meta notation and everything last time, that took us like an hour and a half, but that's okay. Because now that we have it, we'll be able to do lots of other things without it taking so long. Okay? So this was our outline from last time, and everything in gray is everything we did. So we showed that that language was a lot more powerful than we thought, that it had numbers and booleans and recursion and things like that. We decided that substitution was a little harder to define than you might think, but not too bad. And then the last thing we did, and you'll need this quite a bit for homework 3, well, quite a bit, I don't know. We gave a different interpretation using CAML that instead of using substitution, used environments. And what I mean in terms of homework 3 is that interpreter is your starting point. What you're going to do is add a bunch of other stuff to that interpreter. But the stuff you're going to add doesn't actually have to deal with environments. It has to deal with conditionals and pairs and stuff. So that's why I'm taking back the you'll have to understand it quite a bit. But it will be your starting point for the interpreter. Okay? So the next thing we have to do, I would be perfectly happy to skip showing a small step semantics to lambda calculus, because we've seen large step. We just on homework 2 investigated laboriously the difference between large step and small step. But I gotta do it because I want to do continuations, which are so cool, and the only way I know to approach them is sort of through small step. So that's really the only reason I'm doing small step, and it's easy. So it won't take but a minute. Okay? Alright, so here it is. Instead of our judgment E goes all the way to some value, let's define a different judgment that does one step, that says E takes some little step, some sideways arrow, again it's just meta syntax, you can choose whatever you want, to some E prime. Okay? And here's all you have to do. There's only one action rule. That's not a technical term. There's only one rule that does anything interesting, and that's this one, and it's our old friend substitution. It says if your whole program is nothing but a function applied to a value, then the next thing you'll do is that. That does not mean that you're one step from having terminated. Because having done this substitution, you might now have some very complicated program that's going to take lots and lots of steps to evaluate. You might actually have an infinite loop. Right? Our infinite loop, I was talking about this right before we started, lambda xx applied to lambda x dot xx, that has this form. Right? The rule we would do to take a step would be this rule. Okay? But that's not the only possible way we could take a small step. We also have two inductive rules that say, well, maybe I have an application, but it's not yet a value applied to a value. Okay? And for that, I have chosen, as the language dictator, as someone who can write down whatever inference rules I want, I can implement whatever interpreter I want, that I'll do the left sub-expression before I do the right sub-expression. And the way I'll encode that formally is I'll say, well, if the left thing, E1, can become some E1 prime, then I'll do that. I'll become not E1 applied to E2, but E1 prime applied to E2. And what that means is go down the left sub-expression and recursively go find some action situation, some active thing I can do. Okay? Now, that might not work, and it might be because the thing on the left is already a value, which I'm representing with V. I don't like that I just wrote over it. And if that left thing is a V, but the right thing is not yet a value, well, I'm in a call-by-value language, so I better go find some active thing to do on the right side and bring that E2 prime down. Okay? So that is what corresponds to, what did we call this on the homework? Interp small 1? Is that what it's called?
Interp small.
Okay. The one-step thing. Okay? And then just like we did with logo and just like we did with imp, we now need an outer loop. And formally, we usually just write that with a star next to the arrow. And that just says you can go from E to E prime by building zero or more derivation trees out of these where you chain them together. So you have one derivation tree that says you go from E1 to E2. Another one says you go from E2 to E3, then E3 to E4, however many times you want, including zero. And that's what this means. And it occurred to me that no one ever writes down inference rules for this, that it really just is you can take as many steps as you want. But if that bothers you, and I guess it bothered me a couple days ago when I was writing this slide, here they are. It says you can go zero steps and be exactly where you started, or you can go one step and then as many steps as you want, and that means you can still get from E1 to E3. Okay? So that's small step. Now I get to switch back to camel, and we'll do everything with continuations in camel. But now that we understand sort of these formal operational semantics, and I'm going to erase all this because I think it's all useless, the next slide is full of camel code, and it does exactly this. So we could almost skip it, except I need to play with it on future slides. Matt?
In the second inference rule on the bottom,
uh-huh,
where you have E2 going to E3,
mm-hmm,
is it necessarily true that E2 and E3 are different or the same? Or it can be?
No, it's not, because to show this, I need a derivation, and I could use this rule, in which case they'll be the same. Or I could use another instantiation of this rule, in which case they'll probably be different, because E1 steps to E2. And you might think that every derivation with this will produce a different expression. But of course, I've shown you an example where that's not true. But intuitively, it's different. Is that the question?
Yeah.
Cool. Alright, so we did it formally. It was very few symbols. And in camel, it's not too many more. And I thought it would give a nice sort of roadmap since there isn't that much to it. So just to remind you, our syntax in camel looks like this. We have variables that carry strings, lambdas that are string star expression, and applications. And I've chosen constructor names V, L, and A. I have substitution, which I'm not interested in showing you, so I've elided it from the slide. Then I have the one-step relation. Interp 1 is this guy. And then I have interp small, which is kind of this guy, except it runs till it gets a value. Okay? So the way you run until you get a value is if you start with a variable, that's very, very bad. That says your whole program is some x, and I don't know what that means. If my whole program is a lambda, that's very, very good. That's what I want. So let's just return the same expression I was initially passed. And the only other possibility is that my topmost program is an application. So let's take one small step, get some other expression, and then call interp small again. Okay? It's the whole thing. This looks very much like what in homework 2 for your small step logo interpreter was LOOP, because it was a helper function, so we got away with, you know, it was internal, so we got away with choosing a silly name. Okay? All right. So, now we got to do interp 1. On the previous slide, there were three rules, 1, 2, 3. There's going to be three rules on this slide. And just because of ML pattern matching, I'm going to be very careful what order I write them down in. The first possibility is that I have a value applied to a value. Okay? I can tell it's a, so I'm saying I'm an application of a lambda applied to a lambda. So what I should do is the substitution. That's my action rule. I should return out to my caller, which would be in terp small, the substitution of the body of the first lambda, substitute in there the second value, that's this guy, for S1, the variable name of the first lambda. Okay. Another possibility is that my whole program, my outer E, is not itself an application of a value to a value yet, but maybe the first thing is already a value, and the second thing is not. In that case, I want to become, in one step, an application of that same first value to whatever I can take E2 to in one step. And if E1 isn't even a value yet, then I got to do that. And it's just a camel thing that the patterns have to be in this order, because if I put them in another order, for example, if I put this pattern first, well, that's going to match every application. All right? So I just want to not get to applications. I want to make sure that if this is the situation, I do this one. Otherwise, if this is the situation, I want to do this one. So the order does matter here. And I guess I didn't talk about the fact that you're not supposed to call interp1 with things that are already values or things that are free variables. Okay? Questions about this code? Okay? This was the simple version. All right? It's not going to get any longer, but it's going to get a little crazier because we've got to do the hardest thing in the class. Okay? All right. None of this is so important, this slide. There are advantages of small step over large step. Basically, I think we talked about this before, I could kind of detect an infinite loop. What I could do is sort of, I can't detect all infinite loops, but I can detect that I do have an infinite loop. I don't know that I don't have one. I could have interp small keep like a huge hash table of every expression it's ever seen, and every time interp one comes back, see if I've seen that program before. And if I have, like, be like, I'm never going to terminate. That doesn't prevent all divergent computations. You can have divergent computations that just keep getting different. But it does work. Okay? It's closer to what we're about to do, which is a contextual semantics. That's why I went through this medium hop. And it turns out there's this classic thing, and you don't have to know about this, from 1960, this is amazing, which is an implementation of lambda calculus that is basically one while loop plus malloc. Okay? And the way you get there is kind of through small steps. And even now, people play around. This was recently implemented in FPGAs and stuff like that. And it's very cool. But we're not going to talk about it. Okay? All right. Now we're going to do something a little bit different. Let me tell you what we're going to do. Let me actually flip over to a blank slide and tell you what we're going to do. And we're going to eventually use this to build a similar interpreter. It's going to look a lot like our small step, but it's going to be a little bit different. So what we're going to do is, suppose I have some abstract syntax in my program. I'll write app for an apply. Okay? And then maybe over here I have some lambda. So that's already a value. But over here, maybe I have an application where the left thing is not already a value. It's itself an application. And then maybe the left thing is a lambda, and the right thing is also a lambda, and then over here I have some other thing. Okay? So does everyone understand my cartoon of my abstract syntax? I didn't actually show any variables. We don't really like free variables, so any variables that I do have would be under the lambdas somewhere. So there could be x's and y's down here. But the top part of my program is going to look something like this. So if I look at this as a human being, albeit one who studies computer science for a living, I can go and find where the next action step will be. Okay? The next substitution, the next function call. Because what I can do is I can start at the top, and I can see that, well, it's not going to be over here, because that's already a lambda. Right? So it's going to be somewhere over here. And I have a left-to-right interpreter. So since the left thing is not already a value, it'll be somewhere over here. Somewhere over here. It'll be somewhere on the left. I feel like I'm going to muddy my picture, but I'll... Okay, so it's going to be somewhere on the left. Okay, and then I see, well, it's not going to be further down this tree, because this is a lambda. And it's not going to be further down this tree, because this is a lambda, and we don't evaluate under lambdas. So, aha, I found it. I found where my next substitution will be. And that really is exactly what interp small is doing. We can go back and look at the code if you want, but it's doing it, it's finding this, and then it's just immediately doing it. Right? It finds it, it does it, and then it takes the result, which is some E prime, and it builds up some new tree, which is the same top part. New E prime here, same lambda over here. Okay? So that's the cartoon of small step evaluation. Here's the cartoon of what we're about to do. We're going to have a function called split. And what it's going to do is it's going to take this original tree and it's going to return two things. It's going to return this tree, the whole tree, with this subtree, the active subtree, split out of it. Think of this as an appendectomy. It's going to take it out and it's going to replace it with a whole. That's a technical term, a whole. Okay? And it's going to return the active subtree. So what it's going to return is it's going to return a pair. It's going to return something that is a lot like this guy with a big fat hole here. And then it's going to return this guy. Okay? Now, why would we do that? Well, we're building to why, but having done that, we can see how to do interpretation quite easily. What we could do is we could, now that someone else has done this split for us, we could take this, which has now been handed to us on a silver platter. We know the active thing we have. We can turn it into E prime, because we know how to do substitution, and then we could plug it back in. Okay? So that's the motto here. Split, substitute, fill. Split, substitute, fill. That's what we're going to do. Okay? And the rest is coding it up in Camel. Okay? So that's our cartoon. And questions? We can come back to it. It's not going to disappear unless I push this button. I'm going to... No.
I assume there's a why for all of this that you're
yes.
going to get to.
Yes, absolutely there's a why. This seems like we're taking our small step interpreter and making it more complicated. But there's a good reason. Okay, so you got to bear with me. There's a great punchline coming here. Okay, but first we got to do it this way, and I got to show you the Camel code. You don't have to understand every line, but if you have the cartoon in your head, you're in pretty good shape. Okay, so here's the one problem with split. We're defining split right here. Is I cannot have it take an expression and return two expressions, one with the hole in it, and one the thing that was in the hole. And the reason is holes are not expressions. There's no base case for them. It's not in my expression language. Okay? So maybe what I should have done, now that I'm thinking about it, is just cheated and gone back and changed my exp data type to include holes. But let's not do that.
That lets you get multiple holes.
Ah, and Ben's right. The problem with that is then I could allow holes at anywhere in the leaf of my abstract syntax tree. What I'm going to do is I'm going to define a data type, eContext, for expression context, that's only going to allow one hole anywhere. And this is just a little data type trickery. That's not even trickery. It's just I'm going to define something that can only have one hole. So one way you can have a hole is you're a hole. Okay? You're just, that looks like this in our cartoon. Another way is that the hole is somewhere in the left. And on the right is not something that can have a hole, but just an expression. So the picture for that one is, it's like an apply, but in Camel it's going to be spelled L-E-F-T. And on the left is some context, something with a hole somewhere. And on the right is an expression, something without a hole. And similarly, I can allow my hole to be on the right. So that's just a data type definition. Now that I have that, I can define split to return an E context and an expression. And remember, the expression I want to return is the active thing, and the context is everything around it. Okay, just like in our picture. And here's how it works. if your whole expression is an active thing, then you return a whole. I've spliced out my entire program. It's like a degenerate case. And the expression is the active thing. This is, it's almost too easy to describe. If my whole program is what I want to do for a substitution, then my context is just the whole, and my other thing is the whole program. Okay? But that's just the base case of my recursion. Another possibility is that I don't want to do work on the left. Remember my cartoon, when I saw a lambda on the right, that's not where I put the whole. I went down the other way. Okay? So what I do is go ahead and recursively split E2. What that's going to do is it's going to give me back two things. It's going to give me back a context and something active. And whatever its active thing is my active thing. The whole point was to send down in the tree and find the one thing where we're going to do a substitution. But its context is not quite my context. I descended down further in the tree. I had some app with some lambda over here and some expression over here, and now I'm given back some context that has some hole in it, and I have to remember all this other stuff. And I do that by saying my context is something where the hole is on the right, and on the left is this lambda, which was the whole reason why I didn't go down and put the hole somewhere on the left. Hopefully there's at least a high-level idea that this is somewhat like our cartoon. The other case is no more difficult. Okay, if the thing on the left is not a lambda, and if I get to here it's not, then I want to split the thing on the left, play the same game, where now I need to remember this guy, and I have some hole over here. Even if you don't buy the code, you can look at it later. It's been online for a week and a half. We're splitting it out. Okay? Fill is much, much easier to write. Okay? Fill, plugging the hole back in, you take a context, something with a hole in it, and some expression, go find the hole, put the expression there. Okay? So, if you found it, return the expression. Oh, sorry, I should write out the type. This is, it takes an E context, star X, I have a minor reason for not using currying. Don't let it bother you. Return an X. Okay? If that didn't work, well, if the hole is somewhere on the left, then go fill it. Then make an application out of the result of filling that hole recursively with E2. Okay? Now, to take Bob's side for just a minute of surely there's a reason for doing this, here's not the reason. To convince you that E equals split it, fill it back in, it's an identity. That's not the point, but you can actually see that. Okay, we split these two things out, and then you go back in and you put it in the hole. Our point is not to fill it with the same fill. You know, the point is to do something, take that primitive step, and then refill the hole. Okay? And this is the motto I showed you in the cartoon. Maybe I should flip back there. Okay? Oh! You learn something every day. Oh, that's so exciting. Sorry if you guys have been in classes before and new professors could do that. But no one told me. Does it get smaller? Oh, cool. All right. They don't let me play with technology much. They wait till I hit the wrong button. Okay. Okay. So if we go back and hit the right button and go back over here, and I see what happened. Remember, we split. We had this whole thing. We split it like this into something with a hole and something that can do this. And the whole idea was to do a substitution and then fill the hole. And that will get us another small step interpreter. And then it won't be any cooler than the one we had, but we'll be able to do it. Use it to do something very cool. Okay? So this is exactly it. This is interp small. We don't need interp 1 anymore because it's so simple that I've just inlined it. Okay? I've inlined my new interp 1 right here. Okay? My new interp 1, well, I guess I inlined it here.
the split.
And yeah, it's the three steps. They're not all quite next to each other. Okay. So my new interp one is split. Having split, I'm handed on a silver platter the action thing. Do it. Do the substitution. And then fill the context that I was also handed on a silver platter from split. Okay? And then just go around the loop again. This interp small is just your while loop. Okay? So it is split, substitute, fill. And that is the order these things would happen. You have to do the split so you can do the pattern match. Having done the pattern match, you can't do the fill till you evaluate its argument. So you do the split, then the subs, then the fill. Okay? Questions?
And your way out of that recursion is you end up with an L, with a lambda.
That's right.
At the very end, and that's the result.
That's right. Very good. This is the base case of my interp small loop, my exit condition, the base of my recursion, is that eventually I will get a lambda as the thing, and I don't try to split a lambda. That won't work. That'll raise an exception. There is nothing active to do with a lambda. That's a value I'm done with my computation. Okay. All right. Why are we doing this? Okay. Well, first of all, it's yet another interpreter, and I like to write interpreters. But the really cool thing is we now know what a context is. We have the ability to evaluate programs by splitting them into something where the action is and everything else. And that everything else is a continuation. That's a fancy word that says something that if you hand it a value can complete your computation. That's what that context is. You put something in that hole and it can complete a computation for you. It'll do some applies, it'll do some substitutions, you know. Okay? That's a continuation. And so what we're about to do is add something to our language that will let us save continuations and restore continuations. Which sounds like a pretty crazy thing to do. Until about a week ago, it sounded pretty crazy to think you could take a program and save a heap and restore a heap. But you have all now done a homework problem where you saw it wasn't that difficult. Maybe not the best thing to put in your language because it's expensive, but potentially pretty powerful. So we're going to do something pretty similar, except we don't have heaps. What we have are contexts, continuations, things that really, if you like to think in a low level, correspond to your call stack, your control stack. Okay, because this thing with a hole in it is basically everything I had to put on the stack saying, after you're done here, I need you to do this computation. And then after you're done there, I need you to do this computation. There's a stack going on there. And what we are about to do is give ourselves the ability to get our hands on those. And having done that, I'm going to add one language feature, one tiny little language feature, and that's going to be enough to code up exceptions, which makes sense. That changes what you're going to do. You're going to do a throw, cooperative threads, coroutines. I'm not going to go through these examples except briefly, but there's a reason. Continuations aren't just some like obscure feature no one's ever heard of. I mean, they somewhat are. But they're very powerful, and they basically subsume all of these guys. Okay, Matt?
This only works because this stuff is immutable, right?
Only works because this stuff is immutable. Depends what you mean by works. The ability to take your call stack, okay, the computation you still want to do, and store it in a variable, is something you could add to any language. When you combine it with mutation, you can confuse yourself in a hurry. Because you go back to some old call stack, and the contents of variables are different. And yet, that's not totally unreasonable. When you have a thread system, and let's imagine only one thread runs at a time, you run some thread for a while, and then what you do is you grab its stack and you store it somewhere. Okay, in practice you don't actually move it, but conceptually you stop it in its tracks and you go and run some other thread. And when you go back to that first thread, some data has been mutated. Some variables have been changed. And yet it still makes sense to say, now I'm going to continue there. I'm going to run that continuation. I'm going to work on that computation. Does that answer the question, or was I missing the point?
Kind of like iterators in C# too, right?
Yeah, definitely sufficient for any sort of... those iterators are kind of like coroutines. They're a simpler form of coroutine. I don't mean simple in a bad way. They're an idiomatic use of coroutines. So yeah, definitely. Yeah, I should add a dot, dot, dot here. This is certainly not an exhaustive list.
I guess what I meant is it's guaranteed to work if things are immutable. Your program's not going to get screwed up. But once you have mutability, you can make mistakes when you restore state.
Sure. You go back to some previous stack, you don't know where things that were. Sure.
So you have to be careful.
Yeah. Sure. It's a very powerful language construct, so with it, with great power comes great responsibility. All right. Okay, so go back one slide. This is our interpreter. We had fill and split. We haven't done anything cool with them yet, other than get rid of interp1 as just split subst fill. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to extend my language. I'm just going to add two little things. One, I'm going to add a save continuation. That's what letcc stands for. It stands for let current continuation. And it has a string and an expression. And the idea is to evaluate the expression where the string is bound to whatever the context was when I got there. Okay, so that's your save heap, except it's your context, it's your continuation. So evaluate this body with this guy bound to what the context was when you got to this letcc. And if you get to a value in here, then that's your value. But there's another possibility, which is a restore continuation, or a throw, or an apply to continue continuation. And if that happens, this guy's never going to finish. Just like when you throw an exception, you never get back to where you were. Or, I don't know, that's probably not the best explanation. That's all right. Okay. One other change to our language. I need a way to do the restore. I need a way to do the throw. And what I've done, because it worked out a little more cleanly in Camel, was what I've done is I've decided to keep using apply for that. So there's going to be two kinds of apply. There's going to be apply where I do an ordinary old function call like we've been doing for 3 hours. There's going to be an apply that's going to go and completely change my call stack back to some previously saved one. And the way I'm going to know which I'm doing is I've changed the body of my lambda. It used to be exp, just an expression. But now I've changed it to be some data type that says, okay, there's still that old possibility, but there's a new possibility, which is that it's a context. That's not something we're going to write in source programs, but you'll see in the interpreter, we're going to create lambdas whose bodies aren't even expressions. And when you call such a thing, you're not going to do what we used to do. Okay, and I also have context. They're completely unchanged from the past. Okay? So here's the punchline. Here's the complicated... Oh, no. Not yet. Sorry. One more slide till we get to the punchline. Okay. We got to change split. We changed our language, right? We have a new language, so we have to change split, fill, and interp small. And subst, but I never showed you subst. Okay. We got to change split, fill, and interp small. Fill doesn't change at all. Split has all the cases it used to have. Okay? It still has this case that says if you found a function call, that's the hole, and return it, that'll be the next thing that we do. Okay? If you found a lambda on the left, then go find some active thing to do on the right. And if you don't have a lambda on the left, go find some active thing to do on the left. But there is a new possibility. We added something to our language, letcc, and it turns out that is also some action we need to do. So that's another case, just like this next one, where we're going to create some hole and just pass back to our caller, pass back to interp small, I found you a letcc, go at it. Just like in this case, it says, I found you a lambda applied to a value, go at it. Okay? So nothing fancy there, but it is an important part of the puzzle. So now, we just have to do interp small. Okay? Has the same first two cases. It doesn't like free variables. It stops when it hits a lambda. In the remaining case, it still starts with a split. Okay? Still starts with a split. And if that split has, as its second part, has some context for the first part, obviously, if in that second part it has an apply of a lambda to a value. And remember, I have two kinds of lambdas now. So this is the old kind. This is the exp kind. Then do exactly what I used to do. Substitute the value for the argument in the body, fill that hole, and go around the loop. So what I'd like to convince you is, except for adding this data type right here, this is what we used to have. Okay. So I've narrowed down the cool part to right here. Okay. Remember, what I got to do is let CC is going to grab the continuation. It's going to grab that call stack and save it for later. And if I call a function that has a call stack in its body, that's the one I'm going to use now. So let's do the grabbing first. The thing in my hole is a letcc. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to evaluate its body. Now its body might use this S3, and that's supposed to be bound to the current context. And I've got it. It's right here. It was handed to me by Split, and I just injected it into my program. I grabbed it. I reflected it. Whatever word you want to use. It is now in the abstract syntax of my program. Okay? And so what I'm going to do is in this body, instead, anywhere I find an S3, I'm going to plug in this lambda that when you call it, its body is this context. Okay? So that was easy, and that is the whole reason we went through the trouble of defining split and fill, is so that at this moment, on this line, where we wanted to grab the context, we had it. If we don't write split, you can't do this. Right? We don't have it. Okay? All right, now we got it, and that's pretty cool. Got 3 exclamation points on a 3 exclamation point scale. Never go to 4. Now, we got to be able to use these things. The way we use them is you apply a lambda to a value, but it's not an ordinary lambda. It's a funny lambda. It's a continuation. And here's what we do. We take that saved context, that one that at some time in the past was created by a letcc. We fill its hole with the value. And then we go around the loop with that result. And here's what's crazy. When we got to here, when this was our action, there was some context. Right? We got to some position. We had some tree where this was in the active position, and there was some outer thing that we thought we were going to do, and it's gone. We're not using it anymore. It's completely erased, if you will. We go to interp small with the saved context and the value. It might make sense that this works for exceptions. That the way you code up exceptions with letcc is where you wanted a try block, you just grab that context, that's your letcc, and if you want to throw the whole arrays in camel terms, the whole idea of an exception throw is that you stop computing where you are and you pick up computing back up at the try. Okay? And so what we did is when we got to the letcc, we saved that stack, we saved that context, and then when we got to the exception throw, we threw away what we were doing and we just did that other thing. Now, this is more powerful than what you need for exceptions. And the reason why it's more powerful is because when you throw an exception, you always throw it to a, shall we say, suffix of your current stack. Right? You don't actually have to save anything. Right? You already have all that stuff. It's like a subset of your context. I'm using mathy terms for no reason. But when you got to the try block, your stack looked like this, and when you got to the throw, it looked like that. So all you have to do is pop off this much. Right? No need for a fancy letcc for that. But that's not all you can do with letcc. Right? So that's the easy one. Much cooler. Yeah?
Just a long time ago, I learned a C called set jump.
Uh-huh.
Is
right.
That exactly what we're doing here?
That's exactly what we're doing here. This is C's long jump. Oh, Yes, in the sense, okay, I love this. I wish I had put this on the slides. Let's talk about long jump and set jump. Yeah, that's exactly this. Set jump is let's CC, and long jump is this funky apply.
Okay.
But C has a rule that you can't long jump to something if you've already popped off the point in the stack where you did the set jump. Right? It basically leaves in your hands, because C leaves everything in your hands, that you can only do it this way. You're only allowed to do the long jump if the thing you're long jumping to is a suffix of your current stack. And it's your job to keep track of that. Right? But that jump buff, that's actually the type of thing returned by setJump, is let's CC. Great way to think about it. But this language, as interpreted right here, doesn't have that restriction. If you think about how you would extend C to remove that restriction, you'd have to copy the stack. You'd have to say, well, you know what? Someone might long jump to that stack later, after I've popped off more of it. They might say, no, I want to go back to it. And then you'd have to copy the stack. Why on earth would anyone want to go back to a stack who's already been popped off of? Here's my list. Coroutines. Coroutines are the ability to have two stacks and to at any point sort of yield and say, no, I want to run over here for a while. And this one says, no, let the other guy run. And then this one says, let the other guy run. You can add them to your language, or you can just code them up with let's CC. This relies crucially, you can't do this with set jump, long jump. It's just not gonna work. Two stacks on one stack is a recipe for pain. Okay.
And that's just a stack and structure pointers, right? Not variables as well.
As we've defined it on this previous slide, yeah. It's a stack of instruction pointers or return addresses or whatever.
And parameter buckets.
Parameter, yeah. So in that case, it does really have local. Think of it as a... Yeah, I don't want to get into, what if this guy, gives us, an address of X to this guy and he assigns to it. I mean, that stuff's complicated. But can be done. Yeah, it's call stacks. Yeah, it's fine to think of it in instruction pointers. Yeah. Okay, once you have two of these guys, you really like to have N. That's basically, at a high level, cooperative multi-threading. Cooperative means you can't preempt threads and you only run one at a time. So you run a thread until it explicitly says, I'm willing to let somebody else run. Then you let run somebody else until it says, I'm willing to let somebody else run. You can code all this up. What you basically do is you pass around a queue of waiting threads. And I'm willing to let somebody else run. That's the fun one. You basically grab their continuation, their saved let's CC, and you apply it. But you have to apply it to a new thread queue, a thread queue that has yourself in it. How do you put yourself in a queue? Well, you do a let's CC and you add it to the queue. Let's CC says, I can get my continuation.
So but isn't cool. Your continuation going to put something in the queue?
Ah, great point, which is, if it's just a call stack, when you reinvoke it, isn't it just going to do the same thing again? Isn't it just going to be an infinite loop? I mean, it's something. And the answer is no, because we fill it with something. Right? This V basically says, no, you already did the thread yield. Go on. You're past that. Okay. Kind of got to play around with stuff. I told you, it's the hardest thing in the class. I'm really glad we got to do it at 6:30 instead of at 8:30.
Okay, yeah, because you were doing that thread thing,
mm-hmm.
But when you get back to that point,
right.
Fill in that which the code was used to be thread thing,
right?
And now it's the next thread.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Yep.
So I don't know about anybody else, but you lost me about 15 minutes ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let me try to give you the high level, and I'll be happy with that, which is. Did I lose you? Did you follow through? One way to do our interpreter is take this guy, split it into these two pieces, come up with this E prime, fill the hole back in.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay, I got to do binary search.
Okay,
right?
Sure.
I don't have to do. Okay, so forward from there in terms of cartoons, is Let CC, and I wish I had switched back to the cartoon, so I'm glad you stopped me, goes and grabs this guy and binds it to a local variable. It takes let CC, let me write it this way, let CC in E, and says when you get to this guy, what you do is you evaluate E with S mapped to this. What do you mean mapped to that? What is this? This wasn't even in my language. What it is it's some lambda, but it's a funny kind of lambda. And if you ever call this lambda, you
it won't work, right?
What's that?
It wouldn't. You can't call it because it's got a hole, right?
Right, but what calling this funny kind of lambda, and let's not call it a lambda, let's call it a continuation. The rule for calling a continuation is fill its hole with whatever argument you call it with. All right? So if I call this guy with 17, then I go in and I put 17 in the hole using fill. And then all I do for the rest of my computation is this. I completely ignore whatever I was doing when I got to that function call.
So now help me understand how this would be like a throw. So I, like the picture I have in my mind is you call let CC and then you stick that S off somewhere.
Right.
And E is what's inside your try block.
Great.
And you're doing stuff inside your try block. And then, like, how do you get out of your try block? And then when you get out of your try block, what is the new expression you stick in the hole? And how do you get back the S that you saved off?
Good, good, good. Let me just flip to a new slide and show you. You say, let's CC. This is my try. S in. Okay? So it starts here and it ends here. And I go in and I do some computation. And sometime, at some point, I decide I want to do a throw. And so what I do is I do an S of whatever I want to throw. Maybe a number, 4. Or maybe I'm not interested in actually passing a value back out, so unit.
So it like erases everything that you're doing inside there, takes you back in time to when you call that CC and says, okay.
That's it. That's it. The way a lot of people draw their cartoons for this stuff is I got to here, I had some outer context, okay? And in that outer context, I had some let CC. And so what I did is I just started doing the body, and if I ever got to an S applied to something, I immediately forget everything I did in here. Mutations still happened, but I don't have those in this language. And I just replaced this whole thing with whatever that argument is.
So then does a catch kind of like become a match of whatever that new expression tosses out of itself?
Yeah, if you want to do sort of full-blown, you know, you can throw different kinds of exceptions, and if it's not caught, you need to re-throw it. Yeah, you will look at this thrown value. Now, it's a little more complicated than that. This guy out here, all he knows is that this whole thing has been filled with something. So you're going to have to code up a normal termination versus a I threw an exception. Okay? So it is, you know, the encoding's a little more complicated, I guess, than I let on.
But you have matches of different types. And
yeah, yeah. But exceptions already let you do that. In like, even in CAML, you can, I guess I didn't show you many try-withs, but you can, the neat thing about exceptions is that you don't define all the possibilities in one place. Now, there is this idea that in most languages, including CAML, if you don't, if an exception gets thrown that you don't know how to deal with, it just gets implicitly rethrown. Using let CC, you would have to explicitly rethrow it.
So now, how does this picture look different if you're talking about the, what did you call them,
coroutines. The difference is that, again, so when I did this throw, my current stack, it's back to this picture, okay? So this picture is this picture. Right? This outer thing is the deeper part of the stack. My stacks go down. Okay. And the inner thing is the shallower part. And for exceptions, notice that when I threw to this continuation, it was part of my current continuation. It was the outer part. It was the deeper part of my stack. But when you go to fancier uses, to coroutines and things like that, that need not be the case. I'm throwing to something that is not part of my current stack. It's some other continuation over here that I happen to have stored off.
So continuations are like passed back and forth.
Exactly.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And you drew a nice picture of New Mexico.
What's that? of New Mexico. Is that true? It's not over here?
It's
over there? Okay.
Arizona.
I got it right. Oh, that's Arizona that's over here? Something about the Gadsden Purchase. Okay.
So is the parallel threads idea then just two parallel holes? This is a hole within a hole, or essentially, right? Where the operation happens, you know, deeper in the context,
mm-hmm.
and whereas the multiple threads almost seems to be visually like as if it was a block and then just another block.
Well, you definitely have multiple of these contexts floating around. Let me go back one slide. So basically, now that I have the ability to create these at runtime, these things with holes in them, they're first class values. I can make a hash table of them. I can store them in a queue. I can sort them if there was some reasonable comparison function on them. And so the idea of multi-threading or coroutines is, well, now I can just create these whenever I want. Whenever I have a computation, I can stop it in its tracks, grab where it is at that point, and store it off somewhere. Okay? And then I guess compared to threads, if you're familiar, it's closer to Unix fork or C's set jump than it is to thread create. Thread create creates a new empty stack where this grabs your current stack.
And conceivably, you could call SEC and then never ever use that.
That's right. That's right. Let me make that formal for you. For any expression E that does not use variable S, let's see S in E is equivalent to E. Not bad for 720. Yeah. Go ahead.
Are we going to write programs that use continuations?
You know what? I'm leaning toward not bothering. I couldn't go through P505 without showing you this because it's so cool. But I'm leaning. I mean, if we do it, it'll be very simple. And this is fancy stuff. Although I will point out, I mentioned at the beginning of last time, because I thought we might get to this last time. I'm always an optimist. If you want to see cool uses, look at those programs. You have to deal with scheme syntax. So it might be a little hard. Ask me if you can't read them. I posted two papers that basically point out that this is how you want to do CGI programming. Because CGI programming, let me go back to this guy. Is basically the coroutine world. So a very elegant way of thinking of CGI programming is this is the client clicking around on their web browser, and this is your CGI program. But Quisha, raise your hand if you could write a CGI program if your life depended on it.
Like meaning just a user interface?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, some program that runs, that basically every time they click on a web link, it runs. Right, you're guiding them through some online transaction. I don't mean transaction, you know, with multiple steps. Yeah, so what happens is you do the first step, okay, and then what do you have to do? Well, you have to completely code up everything you need for when they click again. All right, there are common tricks for doing this. You can embed this in the URL. You can write a bunch of stuff to disk. You give it a session ID number, you do all this stuff, and then later, sometime in the future, the other coroutine, that 14-year-old on the internet, clicks again, and then you go and grab all that stuff you had, right? Do the next step, write it all back into a URL or to the disk or something like that, right? If only we had some way in our language to say, where am I in my computation, and later, start me up again. Right where I was, just with some value, i.e. what they filled in on the web form or what they clicked. Okay? And that's what those papers basically do, is they show you. The one paper just basically says, like, continuations is what you want, for God's sakes. And the other one says, yeah, but our virtual machines don't actually have them, so here's, like, an automated translation process that has the programmer program in terms of continuations, but then we systematically get rid of them. And it uses some heavyweight stuff, but you know, you're not responsible for it. You might get to page 3 and bail, but it's at least a cool idea. Yeah.
You could do anything with your lambda calculus because it's so powerful.
Right.
But here, instead of coding something up in lambda, you've actually changed the meta language.
Right.
You could change the meta language to do pretty much anything. So why are continuations so cool?
I didn't just change the meta language. I changed my programming language too. Right. I added something that you didn't have before. We already had contexts. We already knew when we were doing some evaluation that when we were done, there was some outer thing. What we've added is the ability to get our hands on it. Okay, it's like in.
I mean, is this cooler than exceptions, or is it more elegant than?
Yeah, in some sense, it grabs them all in one go, which shows there's some underlying similarity. There's a single underlying mechanism that may be too powerful because it's expensive, but there is one mechanism that can do all of this, and that is the ability to grab your context, or in low-level terms, to copy the stack. Okay, and so I guess it's a wow, there's one underlying feature here. These are all known, by the way, if you want to sort of fancy term read, but these are control operators because they screw around with stacks, basically. So that's I guess it's cool that it just subsumes so much. As far as to quibble on your first point, because so in some sense, so in homework two, right, we took imp and we added save heap and restore heap. Imp was Turing complete before we did that,
yeah.
And yet at some sort of intuitive level, it added power. I mean, it didn't add real power. It didn't add what function you could compute, but it seemed like some pretty powerful feature we didn't have before, be able to go back in time according to our heap. And here we're kind of doing the same thing with control stacks. Yeah.
So were those scheme authors assuming for the CGI examples that the continuations included mutated variables?
Yeah.
Because that's a pretty critical one.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So in fact, this is why, so here, I have it here. With mutation, really strange stuff can happen. Because you throw to the continuation and some mutable variables have changed. And it can be hard to understand. So a lot of people call the continuations the go-to of functional programming. It gives you lots of power. You can jump wherever you want. You can grab whatever call stack you want at any time, and at some future time say, oh, no, not what I was doing, that other call stack over there. Right? But if you stick to certain idioms. And that's the argument. By the way, I'm not making the argument. I haven't said this. I might be giving this impression that, gosh, all these silly languages with their exceptions and their coroutines and their threading libraries, we ought to just chuck them all and just use Let's CC. I didn't actually say that. You might think I was giving that impression. And it gets back to the thing of, do you want one super powerful feature that explains lots of other features but can also lead to very hard to reason about code? Or do you want to say, basically, we don't want to give you the full power of Let's CC. It's expensive to implement. It's hard to reason about programs. We want you using these four idioms, so that's all we're going to give you.
So it seems like mutation is why you would have a finally block on your try. Because it basically, the finally is there to clean up all the stuff that you had to stop in the middle of.
Yeah, and in fact, in Scheme, I don't know when they added this to Scheme, but I would imagine late 70s, they had this thing, it's called Unwind Protect, and it's finally. Actually, it was originally called Dynamic Wind. This is funny, and sorry if you don't mind. It was called Dynamic Wind. And the idea was that whenever this continuation popped off past this point, you would run this other code. Finally blocks, interestingly enough, barring some really corner cases of the language, only run once for every try block they enter. Right? You enter the try, and once on the way out, you do the finally. If you have continuations, that might not be true. You do it the first time that continuation was used, and then later, sometimes someone reinstalls that call stack, and you go back through that finally block again. Basically, once you have stacks that can be used multiple times, you might pop them off multiple times. But that whole one is still there, saved in some variable waiting for someone to throw again.
The finally is in the continuation.
Yeah. Right, exactly. So the dynamic wind, the idea was, it is a finally block, but the correct semantics, quote unquote, is that you should run it every time the stack moves past that point. And when I was a freshman in college, I was reading the Scheme manual, and I really thought it was dynamic wind, because they're spelled the same way, and I couldn't figure out why it was called that. So I had to go ask somebody. Anyway.
So I'm just trying to see what this is bringing to us. So we could have done something like this with like save heap and restore heap, except we're not really saving instructions, right? We had save heap and restore heap, we were just saving data, not our current programs.
Right. Correct? So yeah, let's go back to this picture. When we had, let me show you a new picture. A new picture is an imp program. We have some heap that says, x is 7 and y is 9 and z is 12. And what save heap let us do is store in some queue, like this whole heap. but actually a copy of it, one where, because this might subsequently be changed, so one where x is 7 and y is 9 and z is 12. And then we still have this as our current heap, but sometime later we might restore it, and then this is not our current heap anymore, it's this heap, and so on. Okay? What we're doing here is we're doing that with our context, with these guys. Every time I round our interp small, we keep splitting some expression to get some context. And when we do this funky equivalent of restore heap, we don't even use this one. Right? It's not used. There is no CTX right here.
Okay. Sounds like you could almost put the two together.
Yep, you can have them both. If you have the ability to, I think they're both very powerful, arguably too powerful features. Right? TOO. Right? They're too powerful. Right? But the ability to be able to take your current contents of your data, mutable data variables, the current contents of your immutable data variables are not interesting because they won't change. But the contents of your current mutable variables and save them and restore them later, that is fascinating. That is a first class store or a first class heap. Right? Heap and store are kind of synonyms. This is a first class control context, first class call stack. Okay? So I give you the easy one on the homework. But yeah. Yeah, they're both, they're not, neither subsumes the other, they're just both very powerful things.
Okay. Oh, what is let CC completely spelled out?
Oh, it says let with current continuation. So it says let, basically, yeah, I had it on this guy. Yeah, it says, you know, let S be my current continuation. And evaluate E with S bound to it. Yeah. C, the first C stands for current and the second for continuation, and I didn't come up with it. Matt?
And when you define your current continuation, and then you return back to it, S is still bound to it. Mm-hmm. In other words, the current continuation is actually after it contains S bound.
Oh, no, it doesn't actually. When I... So it's a minor point, but it doesn't actually. So remember New Mexico here? When I called S here with 4, and this whole thing just becomes 4. Oh, but you mean in the 4, I could use S. Yeah.
No, but how do you dynamically unwind that? Because you can't get back to that again, right?
Oh, you have to store it somewhere. You have to pass it to some other function or have mutation and store S in a global variable. Yeah. Yeah, I explained, because I had a purely functional language, so if you were doing sort of cooperative multi-threading in a pure language, you would actually like pass this thread queue around everywhere. That's pretty unrealistic. As opposed as I am to mutable global variables, they're a pretty good place to store your queue of waiting threads. Okay, and that's what you actually do. So you grab your S and you put it in this mutable global. Okay. I told you it was the most complicated thing in the class. But it's pretty neat. And it's fun to play with. And I put the code on. I mean, this code's online. Okay? I'm pretty sure we said all this. I wanted to give this sort of lower level view. Think call stack, store the current stack, replace the current stack. You need to fill the stack's hole so you don't have an infinite loop. I should point out, if you were going to compile a program, and CAML is compiled. CAML doesn't have call CC. Let CC, by the way. Scheme does, standard ML, a different dialect of ML does. There are languages with it. You could literally, when you hit a let CC, go and copy your whole stack. Okay? That is pretty pessimistic, especially if the continuation is only going to be used for exceptions. So there are fancier tricks. Okay? A perfectly, remember last time we were talking about like perfectly reasonable models in your head? Copy stack is a perfectly reasonable model, but if you're going to use continuations like in earnest, you might want to check if the implementation were not actually more efficient. Okay? Because there are tricks you can play to basically not copy the stack until you need to. Okay? And one possibility is you don't actually need a call stack at all. You can actually just use the heap for basically everything that was a frame on the stack. Okay, my stack is divided into frames, just becomes a linked list on the heap. Literally with return addresses in it and data pointers in it and everything else. And now you don't have to do any copying, you can just use sharing, and you're done with a stack frame when the garbage collector says you are. And I'll let you ponder over that. Okay?
So
So CAML came after SML.
Right.
Right. So why were they left out of?
Why were they left out? Because they're too darn expensive. I don't know, and people have asked for it now and then. Part of it is the type system. They're a little hard to type check. They're not that hard to type check. We understand it now. It's also, just especially since I'm on the internet, CAML did come out after standard ML, but they kind of came out of slightly different traditions. So the folks at Enria would be very annoyed if I left the impression that they took standard ML and made a dialect of it. They did their own thing and got to their own place. So, all right. I was happy to take these questions. These are great questions, by the way, and convinced me yet again. By the way, that continuations really are as complicated as I think they are. I didn't see anyone like nodding, like, "Oh, that makes sense." Sure, you just grab the context. It was a great thing to do sort of there, because this is like a major, like, as my high school history teacher would say, draw three lines on your notes, we're moving on to the next major thing. That's kind of everything cool you can do with lambda calculus before you add type systems. Okay, so we learned how to do formal semantics, we learned how to model loops, we learned how to model functions, we did formal semantics, we did continuations, and now we're going to move on to type systems. And we are going to continue to use lambda calculus as our model, because that's where a lot of this theory was initially developed, and why throw away all the hard work we've been doing. But it's going to be about types for the next 2 weeks. Okay? Questions before we do that? Comments? All right. Cool. What's that? What do you guys think? You want to do your break now, since it's like it's a logical place? Or are you going to?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's do it. Okay. Cool. We'll start back up in 10 minutes. I think we have everybody back. So that was the heavy lifting. So we'll get back to formal stuff. We have plenty more inference rules in the second half, but we'll start with some less formal stuff, and stuff's just much more straightforward. So I like to introduce types. A lot of people say, "Oh, a type system. Let's have it do this. Let's have this rule. Let's have that rule." And I kind of do type systems for a living. It's kind of what I do. And I always think they're worth kind of going back to first principles and say, you know, why. So I'll take a few minutes sort of explaining why. I have a sermon coming up in 2 slides. And, you know, we'll get back to the formal stuff soon enough. Okay? Okay, so here's the naive thought. And if you push this naive thought, you end up not wanting a type system. So the naive thought is, look, we want powerful programming languages. Yes, we also want them to be fast, and sort of they're all Turing complete as long as you're not like incredibly naive, you know, silly about what you define. So, but we don't just want lambda calculus or just want IMP. We want really flexible, reusable things. We want functions, we want continuations, we want save heap, we want, I don't know, templates, we want, you know, whatever. But we just want more features, right? We want more ways of expressing what we want to do, more ways of structuring our data. And then you want lots of conveniences to keep programs short. So you actually want like floating point numbers, not you know, lists of bits, and you know, the programmer codes up floating point multiplication. Right? So if you take that route and you just say, look, it's all about the features, it's all about the power, then types are totally a step backward. Because like I kind of said in lecture one, if you remember back that far, the whole point of a type system in sort of our language definition is to reject programs, which, as I put in the slide, allow fewer programs. It's this filter between we have abstract syntax, and before we hand it off to interp or translate, we're going to chuck some of the programs and tell the interpreter, you don't have to worry about those. You, the interpreter, only have to interpret programs that get past our type checker. Okay? So if this is all you care about, type systems are a waste of time. But obviously there's, you know, more slides. And so it's worth going through. What do we care about that's not on this list, right? And so the first one is we just like to catch stupid mistakes early, right? So this is the most obvious use of type systems, and we will talk about this a fair amount, but it's kind of the boring one. I don't think it's enough. I don't think it's enough of a reason to push type systems all the places we've been pushing them. So what I mean by stupid mistakes, I mean like 3 plus hello. You're not supposed to write that. It doesn't make any sense. We want to catch that before you hand it off to interp, and interp raises an exception that says bad use of plus. Okay? We don't want to get bad use of plus. We want to know when we made this mistake that happened. Here's another example, a slightly less trivial one, where string append is supposed to take two arguments. I only passed it one. So now what I do is I'm passing print string a string arrow string. Right? And this is a shameless plug for Ben's research, and the reason why he's collecting all this data for Seminole is what you get right now in Camel is a message that literally says print string expects a string, but you gave it a string arrow string. And that is a good use of a type system. Right? If you actually try to run this program, you're going to get in real trouble. If you imagine this as a C programmer, print string is going to be looking for a string. It's going to actually be given a code pointer. It's going to try reading that code. And if you interpret it as a string, it's going to be nonsense. Okay? So it's a problem. And the shameless plug for Ben's research is he actually wants to change the error message to this doesn't type check, but if you had put a string right here, it would have. The argument is that that's a better error message. Please.
Also embedded in this example is string.append. Is append is a member of a type string, at least. So that's useful also.
Yeah. What's that?
Scoping functions.
Yeah. I think I'm missing the point.
It's not append. It's a append of a string.
So oh, right.
My type has described the fact that I'm appending strings.
Yes, yes, yes. My type is describing that this is a string arrow string.
Append is in the string type. Or I don't know how it's done it. In C, it would be, you know, string would be a struct.
Oh, this dot is module system. Think namespaces. Think colon, colon.
It's just a convenience fact. I mean, you've been writing it so far as a caret to concatenate strings.
Uh-huh.
And carrots are syntactic sugar for string.append, but the only reason it's string dot is because it's defined in string.ml somewhere, and that's just where they chose to stick it in the library.
Yeah.
I mean, you could have any function you wanted there, and if you forgot an argument, this is the error message you would get. Chances are good it'll take you, 10 minutes to figure out what's going on.
Right. I see. Yeah, I chose a confusing example. I think we've cleared it up. Okay. I should point out that these stupid mistakes that refuse to compile your program may be, it's great to catch mistakes early, but not things that aren't actually mistakes. So if you are, say, using some sort of preprocessor, it might be really convenient to just generate some code that, because of some preprocessor flags, wasn't actually reachable, and to not require that unreachable code, that code that could never be called, to type check. Okay, and type checkers don't allow that, right? They're always, they just don't, right? So, there is this, catching stupid mistakes early. There's also the issue of, we're throwing away, and I'll get into why in a few minutes, you're throwing away programs that don't have stupid mistakes. Every type system out there for every language I know rejects programs that don't actually have stupid mistakes, all in the name of rejecting programs that do. Okay? It's also the question of which stupid... You can't prevent all of them, so, there's some expression, right? You can't fix stupid. You can fix it part of the way, but you'll never fix it all the way. Okay. Of course, I'm talking about my programming, not anybody else's. Okay. So, second reason, and it's related, I suppose, is to prevent getting stuck or going haywire. So the idea is... And I guess this is similar to a stupid mistake, only let's say it's not a stupid mistake. It's not something like as naive as this. You have some big program, and the way you've combined different components just doesn't make sense. Well, that's not stupid. I mean, it's hard. I mean, this is the hardest thing humans have ever attempted to write large software, in my opinion. Is a type system lets you know that as interp runs, as you evaluate, you cannot ever get to some point where the next step makes no sense. And that's a lot different than where I am right now makes no sense, or on these 500 test cases, I always terminated with a good answer. It says no matter what my inputs are, I will never get to a point where the next step makes no sense. Okay? That's what type systems do. But there are other ways around this. And they're cheats, but they're cheats we should understand, and I think they strike to some of the key differences in programming languages. One way is to say, you know what? We control the makes no sense definition. If we don't ever want to get to a point where the next step makes no sense, we'll make every step make sense. Okay? So, you know, we'll say, well, that cast didn't work, so we'll just throw a class cast exception. Now it makes sense. It makes perfect sense to try to treat a foo as a bar. What you get is an exception race. If you're in a scripting language, some of my least favorite scripting languages, they say, oh, 3 plus hello, that makes sense. And depending on your scripting language, you either get the string 3 hello, you get that in some languages, or in others you get 3, because they try to convert hello to a string and they get 0. And they just say, that makes sense, that makes sense, I'll keep going. All right? And beauty is in the eye of the beholder. I mean, that's, you know, we are defining a language, and if we want everything to make sense, we can have everything make sense. Okay? And, you know, whether that's a stupid mistake or a useful feature depends on what you're programming and why. Okay? So that's one way. And type systems don't take that approach. They actually want to throw out this program and never accept it. What I will go on a sermon about is, I'm okay with this if you're okay with it. I think that there's deep sort of psychological or social science or software engineering reasons not to, in most cases, but from a language definition standpoint, okay. What I'm not happy with is saying, if you step out of what I know makes sense, then interp or translate or whatever can do whatever it wants. Okay? So this is my attempt at mild humor, but there's a method to my madness of, you know, can we state this super formally? So this is my definition of C arrays. Let's take imp and let's add C arrays. Okay? So here's what you do. Let's say you have an array assignment, just like in C. E1 sub I equals E2. And I've even simplified it. I made I a constant. Okay? So E1 evaluates to some array literal. I'd have to extend my language to support such things and so on. And E2 evaluates to some integer I. And I is greater than N. This is an array bounds out of bounds access. All right?
The I above is not the same as I below, right?
Oh, no. E2. I meant E2 and E3. Here, just get rid of that one. Sorry, I'll fix this later. There we go. Fixed. Thank you. Good. All right, so here's... perfect. This is all I need. I thought I was doing the more E1 sub E2 equals E3, and I got a little confused. Okay. So here's what the C standard says, actually, is that if you're in this state... and you can satisfy both of these preconditions, in particular that I is greater than the length of the array, the interp is allowed to step to any heap and any statement it wants. That's what it says. Okay. I have this 600-page standard on my shelf, and it's quite clear on this. It doesn't use inference rules, but that's exactly what it says. Okay. The problem with this, besides the obvious that this costs the economy billions of dollars a year and blah, 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 and you know, you've all been sent to training seminars on why you need to check your array bounds and all this. From a programming language standpoint, the problem is, if this is in your language, you'll never be able to prove anything useful about your program until you get rid of the array bounds errors. You'll never be able to say, like, oh, well, this code over here behaves like such and such. Because as soon as you make one little function call into some other code, if it has an array bounds error, it sends you to some arbitrary state, and then you can't reason about it. Right? And that's just a very formal way of saying what you already know, which is, if you are in a language where you have rules like this, anything you ever say about your software always has this caveat that says, assuming I've never made any of these mistakes. And so to the extent that type systems prevent some of these mistakes, it's more useful because it means we don't have to have these rules around. Okay? And that's my sermon. All right. So we had this list. I'm going back here just for a second. Why have type systems catch stupid mistakes, prevent getting to a situation where you don't want to have a language definition. That's what it means. You get stuck. You don't want there to be a next step. So here's some others. This is actually the one we will get to. It'll take us a couple weeks, but I actually think is the biggest reason to have type systems, which is they are a very convenient way to enforce strong interfaces. What I basically mean by that is you can set up an abstract type, you can set up an interface, an API, and here's my canonical example. Let's say you have a set API. I stick with simple ones that I can talk about without even putting them on the slide. You have a set with insert and remove and union and intersection, you know, whatever library you want. If you implement it with lists, and then someday you come along and say, oh, it's running too slow, I want to swap in a hash table implementation, with a type system, with a notion of interfaces and abstraction, you can know that none of your clients will behave any differently. Right? That's incredibly powerful. It's the only way I know to, with tool support, with automated support, today, you know, really take a large software system and be able to swap in something and know that it's right. I'm not saying don't test it or anything like that. But the point is, you know, because of the type system, that no one was able to assume how you had implemented it, instead only the interface. Okay? I will point out, going back to my sermon, that if you don't have sort of your basic safety, you can't have this. It's kind of a necessary prerequisite. Turns out reason four to someone who spends their life writing compilers is actually the same as number three, except that the person implementing the interface is now the compiler writer. So the idea is that with a type system, the compiler can actually do things faster. It knows that you can only treat ints as ints, not as some funky lambda that you might call and use for something else. So it can do things faster. I'll give you a very degenerate example. If you separate out Booleans from integers, the compiler can represent Booleans in one bit and know that you're never going to look at other bits. Whereas in C, where ints and Booleans are confused, they can't do that. That is not the reason why we separate out Booleans. It really has to do with preventing stupid mistakes, but it's a simple example. Okay? Not a particularly compelling one. Okay. So another way to say this, and this is this point here, is that type systems make it really easy to do compiler optimization. Right? Don't go figure out some obscure fact about the program. Just read it off the type. Make the programmer tell you. Gee, I can't tell whether this might ever hold a string. Oh, it has type int in a nice type-safe language? I guess it doesn't. Right? You're done. Okay. Other things that types are used for, static overloading. It's not so interesting from a PL perspective. The idea that basically if I have E1 plus E2, once I have a type system, I could use the types of E1 and E2 to decide which plus you actually wrote. Did you write integer plus or some overloaded plus or some 51st version of plus? It's basically syntactic sugar. It's not so interesting. I'm not saying don't ever use it or it shouldn't exist in languages. I'm just saying it's not interesting. What is interesting is object-oriented programming or late binding or dynamic dispatch or waiting till runtime, looking at some type tags of E1 and E2 and deciding what function to call. And that we will get to, but it'll take us 3 or 4 weeks. Okay? And finally, everything's a type system these days. This is basically, if there is something you would like to take the set of all programs and sort of filter some out, you can probably express it as a type system. Okay? So this is used done all the time in research and foundationally in some of the software tools that are out there, including tools built and used in the greater Seattle area. A nice way to specify sort of multi-threaded programs that can't have data race conditions is you make part of a pointer's type the lock that must be held to dereference the pointer. Okay? And then you can, now that you made that part of the type, you can check that whenever you dereference the pointer, you hold the lock. And you can express that as a type system. Is it onerous for programmers? Sure, type systems are always onerous for programmers, but they prevent mistakes. Okay?
I'll throw another one that's familiar to a lot of you. For everybody who works at Microsoft and runs prefast on their code every day that they build their code, all the prefast annotations on your types where you say this buffer is counted by this parameter and this thing is guarded by this and so on, all of that is a type system. The analysis does extra types that C doesn't have and spits out a ton of warnings telling you that your code isn't type safe. And by isn't type safe means you've got buffer problems. And so what they did was they recast this analysis into a type system and ran it.
Yeah.
And it works.
Yeah. Yeah, and John Pincus, if you're listening, he's the one who originally wrote prefix and prefast and this stuff. That is a fairly accurate description that the developers might not agree with. But yeah, you can think of these things that way. And in general, if you don't want to call it a type system, don't call it a type system. A filter on source programs, conservative filter, you know, we use it for lots of different bugs, not just you tried to apply an integer and the function expected a string. Okay? Yeah. But Ben's absolutely right. Okay? And so we won't be, you know, we're not going to be able to focus on all these, but they are definitely motivating everything we're doing. So this is our outline for the next probably 6 hours, maybe more. We're going to go back to the formal stuff. We're going to add a type system to our lambda calculus. Actually, first we're going to add integer constants, because the type system where all you have is functions is a little too boring. Then I'm going to argue why the type system we added has some good properties, basically that it does have this you won't get stuck. And I'll give you the sketch of that argument, because it is a very powerful reasoning technique for programs. Then we will finally say, Dan, this lambda calculus is just way too stupid. We got to add more stuff. We need data structures, you know. And it turns out a lot of our encodings from last time won't work anymore because our type system would throw them out. Okay, so we're going to add them to get around that. And we will not finish this today. We will finish somewhere in here. And the next time we will have, I will sort of give you reasons why static type systems are good and reasons why they're bad. And I will not tell you which is better, because I think this is kind of like, I don't know, what's the standard, you know, it's just an endless debate. And the point is you need to understand the advantages of detecting errors at compile time versus at runtime. I will do the mathiest thing we'll do in the whole class, which is to show you that if you believe that propositional logic is not a hack, then you have to agree that lambda calculus is not a hack. You have no choice. There is a fundamental connection between them, which we figured out in kind of 1980 or so. Then we'll talk about subtyping, very related to OO programming, but we'll do it before we get to OO. Then we'll talk about generics and some related things. So this is kind of the fancier stuff. This is the simpler stuff, but we got to do this first. And then we'll talk about type inference. I won't teach the whole thing, but I want to at least demystify what ML is doing, because the ML algorithm to figure out what types he wrote is actually incredibly simple. It fits on a slide with a couple helper functions swept under the rug. Okay? So that's it. Oh, the helper functions aren't complicated. It's just you need a second slide for them. All right? Okay. So here we go. Here's our new term language. We're going to have a type language too. So here are expressions and values. We're going to add types. And all I've done, I told you, is add integer constants, and they are values. All right, there's nothing else to evaluate them to. So, you know, C is in the set, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4. You can have the negatives if you like. Okay. So I probably should, just to convince you this isn't silly, also add, like, addition and multiplication and subtraction. But I may as well point out to you that you don't really have to. What you could do is you could have just your program E. Just imagine when you run it that it's really lambda plus dot lambda minus dot whatever other functions you need, and then you apply these to like some things provided in the standard library, right? And now the only difference is instead of writing this character, you know, just because I don't have that in my language for X, you know, anytime I want to add, I'll just call the plus function, the argument I was passed to. This is a really good idea for keeping language definitions small. CAML does a pretty nice job of it. Of a lot of the things you probably think of as built in are simply pervasives. They're simply provided by a module that's by default in scope when your program starts. And what that does is it keeps you from having to find typing rules for all of them and putting special cases in your interpreter. What you do is you have one case in your interpreter that says, oh, this is a primitive. Go grab the assembly code for it, rather than having a case for plus and a place for minus and a case for star, for times, and so on. That's one reason. And then on the typing level, we're not going to have to come up with typing rules for plus. We'll just say, as pervasives does, to the type checker, if you ever see plus, both the arguments are supposed to be integers. Okay. So we don't need a special case in our typing rule. We just have a table of these. All right. And libraries and tables are pretty similar. Okay. Okay. So this is our language. Why did I add constants? Because, and this is hugely important, now I have bad programs I didn't have before. What I'm going to try to do with my type system is prevent getting in a situation where I want to apply 3 to lambda x.x. That said, I did have bad situations before. Did anyone think of one? I had ways to get stuck before.
You had like a value and then an expression.
Yeah, so infinite loops, this is actually a great question. So I think infinite loops are bad, you think they're bad. Our type system is not going to have a problem with them. Okay? It might be really nice to have our type system prevent infinite loops, but we're not going to have that goal. So a wonderful nomination, but I have to reject it because I already made 40 slides that assume we're not going to stop it.
So just a raw x?
Yeah, x. X is stuck. So is x applied to lambda x dot x. Okay. And these are basically the two problems we might have. We might have some variable where we don't want a variable. We might have some integer where we don't want an integer. I guess the third possibility is we might have some function where we don't want a function, but heck, where don't we want a function? Well, maybe as an argument to plus. If we had added plus to our language, we wouldn't want to add lambda x dot x to lambda y dot x, or something like that. Okay, so this is what we're trying to prevent. Okay, so this is formalizing this notion. Okay, so the key question is, can a program get stuck? Okay, and here's what I mean. A program can get stuck if all three of the following hold. You might forget this, if this was on like slide 2. That means can take any number of steps you want. So you start with some program E, and after some number of steps you get to E1. Okay, that's rule number one. Rule number two is E1's not a value. Okay, if you get a value, you're stuck, but you're also done. Right? You've terminated, right? We don't call that stuck. We call that success. And you can't take another step. So we ran for a while. We got somewhere that we're not a value. And we can't take another step. And if that can happen, then you can get stuck. Okay? So we started doing this on the last slide. Here's an example. One example is you have an integer here and a value here. Okay? Because at this point, what I'm supposed to do is a function application, but I can't. These are the only three dynamic rules I have. This one doesn't apply because E1 is already a value. This one doesn't apply because E2 is already a value. And this one doesn't apply because 3 does not look like lambda x.e. So we went 0 for 3. And if you go 0 for on instantiating your rules, you're stuck. Okay? So another possibility we talked about is you have some x applied to v. And we can go through this again. For all the same reasons that using 3 didn't work, using x won't work. Okay? Does this completely describe all the programs that are stuck?
You can describe 3 by itself.
Sorry, constant. Yeah. A constant applied to a value or a variable applied to a value.
Bare variable is also stuck.
What's that?
Bare variables.
Oh, bare variables are also stuck. Good. Yep.
The unemerging cluster, like live lock, where it keeps going back and forth between two different.
Yeah, let's call that an infinite loop, and let's not call that stuck. These are all very, very small abstract syntax trees. Turns out you can have very large abstract syntax trees that are stuck.
Lots of x's.
Yeah, you could have x applied to x applied to x. Right, that'll be stuck. Oh, no. Yeah, that'll be stuck. You could have, I have some 3, and I'm going to apply it to lambda x dot x, and then when I'm all done with that, I'm going to apply it to lambda y dot y. And that will be stuck, right? Because I have some E1, E2, E1 is not a value, so the only rule I could possibly use is this one. But recursively, I won't be able to take a step with E1 for reasons we went through before. So I just wanted to emphasize you can be stuck sort of arbitrarily deep in your call stack, which seems very obvious when I put it that way, very non-obvious when I write down the lambda calculus syntax. Okay? So I think the key first step when defining a type system, and people don't actually do it this way, but I wish they did, is to think carefully about what your stuck states are and what you want to avoid. Okay? So I actually did something that I've never seen anyone do, which is actually write down a grammar of the stuck states. Okay? We wrote down a grammar of the values, the happy termination. Now let's write down a grammar of the stuck ones, the unhappy, I have nowhere to go. And I think this is right.
Pretty sure. X.
What's that? I have to add X. I am missing one, see?
Yeah. Do you have to add C as well? Are you stuck if you just get a constant?
No, and here's why. I decided as the language dictator, I'm going back two slides, that that was a good kind of stuck.
Okay.
Okay? And you know what? If I wanted to tell Ben he was wrong, all I would do was add X. And I'd be like, no, 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 that's a good kind. And this is actually a key point when you're defining a type system. It has everything to do with what you said was a value.
Okay.
And people don't emphasize this because sort of what's a value is kind of intuitive, but they should. Okay. All right, so I forgot one as usual. And these are my inductive cases, right? This BNF says I can be anything that's stuck applied to any expression, and this says I can be a value applied to anything that's stuck, and I'll still be stuck. Okay. Good. So we said that most people don't realize that it depends on your semantics and your definition of values. And of course, you can add cheat rules. If I want to get rid of any of these, here's a way that variables are not stuck. I just add a rule. It says if I have an x, I step to, how about 7? You like 7? Okay. I can define whatever rules I want. So type safety, or you don't get stuck, has everything to do with what your rules are. So before you start talking about a type system, you have to say, are these the rules I like? Did I leave any out? Do I want any more? Okay, we agree on the semantics. Given this semantics, I've got a collection of stuck states. Now, can I define a type system that will prevent ever getting to one of these states? Matt?
Why is lambda x dot e applied to x stuck?
Again, we could decide not, but this rule right here says that to do this step, this has to be a value, and my values do not include variables. Okay. I focus on the rule that's closest to matching. To actually be stuck, you have to show that every rule doesn't match, but indeed none of them match. I gave the intuitive answer, which is we said you have to apply to a value. In general, you have to say, I have to prove to you that there is no derivation. But, you know, we're friends and you know, we see that there isn't one. So, okay. Other questions? All right, key definitions. Hugely important. I wish I had put these in blue. I'll circle them in blue when I get to the keyword. A type system is sound. This is just a definition. This is not a proof. This is just a definition. A type system is sound if it never accepts a program that can get stuck. Okay? So if it accepts your program and passes it off to interp, that program can never get stuck. That seems natural enough. Okay? However, having a sound type system is not the only thing you're interested in. Here is an example of a sound type system. No. I take your program and I say no. And I never accept a program that can get stuck. Okay? It meets the definition. It is a sound type system. It is too restrictive, but it is sound. It's just a definition. The converse, basically, is complete. These are words that come out of the logic world, if you're wondering where these words come from. A type system is complete if it always accepts a program that cannot get stuck. I stated it that way so that the definitions would match up. It's not necessarily how you think about it. Type system is complete if it never gives you a false positive. A type system is complete if whenever it rejects a program, that program actually could get stuck. It's not just erring on the side of caution. It actually has a problem. Okay? So it's, again, just the definition. The type system that accepts everything is complete. So these things really are converses. Right? The type system that says, oh, you have a program? Lovely. Carry on. Is complete. Okay? All right. So these both seem, these are both, I doubt anyone, these are desirable properties. Okay? They're desirable properties. Being sound is good. Being complete is good. And not surprisingly, you can't have both. Like any non-trivial thing in computer science, it's uncomputable. Okay? It's uncomputable for any Turing complete language. It's so since we're doing lambda calculus, if you accept, if you remember back to any sort of theory of computation course, it is undecidable to take a program in a Turing complete language and decide whether it terminates or not. Right? So the way you do a reduction is you show that if you could do this other thing, then you could solve the halting problem. Okay? So here's what we do for lambda calculus. Assume that E has no constants or free variables. Well, it turns out if E has no constants or free variables, it's like this pure lambda calculus term, which is Turing complete, and it would never get stuck. Right? All you ever do is apply functions to functions. There's no way to get stuck. There are no integer constants. You'll never hit a variable. That's not a proof. You would actually have to prove it, but it's intuitive, I hope. Okay? So then what you do is you ask, does this program ever get stuck? Well, it gets stuck if this ever becomes a value. So if I could be sound and complete, if I had a type system that was sound and complete, I would have to reject this program if and only if E terminates. So reductions always feel backwards. They always feel like you're standing on your head. This is probably bringing back horror stories for some of you. But it is a reduction from the halting problem. Okay? So we can't have both. Typically in programming languages, we aim for soundness, and we try not to be too restrictive. For tools on the side, things like prefast and other things like that, sometimes they make the exact other decision. They decide, if I tell them something, it better actually be worth fixing. And I'm willing to miss bugs rather than swamp them with warnings. That would be a tool that's sacrificing soundness in favor of completeness. And then there's tools that are just kind of ad hoc, and they're not sound or complete. Like, I'll make a best effort to, what some people say, you know, find code smells. Okay? And those are useful tools, but from a formal, they're a little less interesting to talk about, because how do you say if they're right? You say, well, they're useful, but how do you say they're right? Okay, then, okay, fine, they're useful. All right. Okay, so what do we do with the fact that we can't have soundness and completeness? Do we get to go home an hour early? Nope. Nor do we get to conclude that the old conclusion that, well, since no type system can ever be perfect, we better have an unchecked cast in our language. Okay, this actually has a motto. It's called strong types for weak minds. Okay, so a strong type system is one that doesn't let you around it. The idea is that you only need one if you don't have enough strength in your head, which I think was fine when one person could write a computer program. As I like to, actually, there's a guy at, I won't say his name because I'm on the internet, but there's a colleague of mine, he probably would like me to say it, but I haven't asked him, who says, actually, really what we should do is, in languages like, say, C or C++, the syntax of an unchecked cast is you write a type, which I write as a Greek letter tau because I'm an academic, then some pointer, and then some expression, and that's just the wrong syntax. It shouldn't just be a type and an expression. It should have two other fields for your name and your evening phone number. And then our languages might be a little more usable. So, all right. So the idea is that if we're going to do a sound type system, we want false negatives. That's another term, kind of a definition. A false negative is I missed a program that could get stuck. We want those to be impossible. Now, we can't also make false positives impossible, but hope to be rare. So the idea is to be sound and expressive. Okay? We want to make workarounds reasonable, and the argument is, if every once in a while we make you code things the hard way, but we don't have crashes and viruses and stack smashing attacks, it's worth it.
False positive means the type is okay.
Yeah. A false positive means I've rejected your program, but there's actually no way it could go wrong. Okay? So I can, and you can always give silly examples. I kind of stick with silly examples because they're short, which is like, well, you know, this array index expression, you know, looks like it might be too big. And it's like, oh, no, 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 because of this, like, deep mathematical property, right? You know, I took up here, I took mod of this thing, and I divided by 2, and if you divide by 2, you always have something smaller, and you always have, you know, an even number, and, you know, stuff like, I guess that's not true, but, you know. And you string it all together, and this couldn't ever possibly be out of bounds. And then the argument is, you know, can you make the tool shut up? And if you do, should you have to provide your evening phone number? You know, so that's the question. All right, so that's the background. Now we're actually going to try to do it. And as I like to do, I feel very strongly on this stuff. If I just show you the answer, it looks blatantly obvious. So I thought what we would do is we would take our simply typed lambda calculus. Our lambda calculus. It has lambdas and constants and variables and applications. That's all it has. And we'll try to come up with a type system. This first one will be really silly and it won't work. Okay. All right. So since we have two kinds of values, integers and functions. Let's have two types, integers and functions. Okay, so this is a new syntactic class. You know, we write down types differently when we write down expressions. So it's an int or it's a function. And now we need to have a type checker. So I could go and write one in CAML, and in all likelihood in homework 4 I will, and you'll extend it. But rather than do that, I'll use the blue background and, you know, the fancy stuff. And I'll go ahead and show you what papers in programming languages do for meta syntax. Which is they use this really funny character, which looks absolutely terrible in the fonts provided by PowerPoint. And I thought about installing my own font, but I was scared of the distance learning stuff. And I'm getting this nod, like, don't even think about installing your own font. It's this guy like this. It's like the sideways T. It's called a turnstile. Like when you're at a sporting event, you go through the turnstile. Like that's kind of what this looks like if you squint. Anyway. We typically say this expression, the way to pronounce this is expression E has type tau. Okay? That's all it is. The rest is meta syntax. The colon is has type, and this turnstile is just there for fun. Not so much for fun. Pretty soon, in fact, in a couple slides, we're going to put some stuff over here, and it kind of separates the stuff on the left from the expression. But it's just meta syntax. Yeah.
So what language do you write turnstiles in for your papers then?
Oh, I don't use a WYSIWYG editor. I use a program called LaTeX, which is pretty much what we all use, and it has a completely different set of fonts. And I will say in general, the fonts in Tech and LaTeX are extremely beautiful fonts, which is not to say that that's the way you should write papers or other things are bad, but that's why people like them. Like it. It also is very easy to do math. It's most people I know prefer it to things like equation editor and other sort of more GUI oriented ways to write mathematics. But hey, there's no accounting for taste, and you know, you asked the question. Okay. Okay. So this is our judgment. This is what our judgment looks like. Okay. So now we're going to have rules, and we're gonna say if there is a derivation showing that E has some type, then it's in. Okay, we get to pass it to interp. And if there's no derivation, then we don't get to pass it to interp. Okay? So, something type checks if there exists a derivation of this judgment. It's as simple as that. Okay? So now we have some programs. Let's write down some inference rules. We'll have a type system. Okay? So here's a rule that I like a lot. It's an axiom. It says that if you have a constant C, it has type int. Seems logical enough. Here's another rule. It says if you have a lambda, it's a function. Seems logical enough. And the only other thing in our language, well, there's variables. Huh, that seems kind of problematic. What type should a variable have? I don't know. That's why I didn't put a rule on the slide. That's why this isn't going to work at all, in part. So let's skip those. But I do have application, so maybe I can come up with a good rule for application. And let's see. I totally think that E1 should have type function, because I'm going to apply it to the result of E2. Right? Remember, my dynamic semantics hasn't changed. The rule, when I actually call interp, is totally the same. Evaluate E1 to a value, evaluate E2 to a value, do the substitution. If I'm going to do that, I want E1 to be a function. Now, E2, it's not clear what it should be, but for the sake of putting something on this slide, let's say it should be an int, and let's say the result of the application should be an int. Okay. Seems reasonable enough.
Can you really say that? Because you have no idea what E1 is going to do. Could it
that's
just,
right.
Could ignore E2 and return a lambda.
Yeah, that's right. If E1 happens to be something that returns a lambda, this is a really bad idea to say that E1, E2 returns an int. So for example, if I have lambda x, lambda y dot y, applied to 7, okay, then according I can actually derive that this whole thing has type int. I can derive it because this thing, E1, can have type function using this rule, and 7 can have type int using this rule. And then I can use this rule to say, therefore, the application has type int. And yet, when I run this program, I get back a function, which, while not stuck, is a pretty good hint that we're not doing something right. So, yeah. I wonder if that's the one of the examples I actually have on the next slide. No, not quite. All right.
Number three.
What's that?
Number three. What
number three? Oh, I just used 3 instead of 7. Yeah. Okay. All right. So we've already talked about this one. That's actually not a showstopper. It's a big hint that we've done something really smelly and wrong. But technically, we haven't. It doesn't get stuck. And, you know, okay? Here is something that gets stuck. Okay? Once I do this application, I get y, right? I substitute 3 for all the x's in the body. And that is stuck. So I accepted it. This can type check. I'll leave it to you to do the derivation. So it type checks, but when I run it, it gets stuck. And that means I'm unsound, by definition. Okay, that's not a value statement, that's employing the definition. And it's a value statement. Here's another thing that's really dumb about this, which is, why did I say that function arguments always have to be integers? I mean, I can do that, but wasn't the whole point of lambda calculus that I could pass functions to other functions? I mean, it seems pretty degenerate to go to all this trouble to define lambda calculus and say, oh, you can only pass integers to functions. Not integer constants, you could do things that evaluate to integers, but I would never be allowed to accept this because this is an application. There's the first part, there's the second part, and I'm applying a function. So this can't have type int, so I would reject it. If you actually run this program, you get 3 out because you substitute the identity function in for x, and then you apply the identity function to 3, and you get 3. So this is a proof of incompleteness. Now, that's okay. I mean, our type system is going to end up incomplete, but it seems pretty egregious. Okay? So that's where we are. It was not a bad first attempt. It actually showed you what our judgments will look like, at least in part, but we're going to have to do better. Okay? Oh, and by the way, I still have no way of talking about variables. Right? At all. Okay. So here's what we got to do to get it right. Enough suspense. Okay? We can't just say, oh, you have a lambda, I guess it's a function. We actually have to type check the function body, right? If you write a function in C, you don't just look at the first line and say, oh, it type checks. You look at the body. Okay? So we're going to have to, when we have a lambda x.e, go and type check the e. But when we do that, we're going to have to allow you to use x in there. I mean, that's the whole point of having functions. You don't have to use x in there, but we have to allow you to. And in terms of a phrase we used last time, we said, well, E might have free variables. It might use X. X is allowed to be a free variable in there. It won't be a free variable in there. By the way, part of homework 3 is computing free variables of lambda terms. So if you don't like that phrase now, you will. All right. So that's the first thing we got to do is we got to support, well, what happens if when I'm in here type checking, I find some variable X, what type does it have? That seems brutally important. Okay? The second thing we have to do is we can't just say every function takes an int and returns an int. Right? We're going to allow functions to take things of sophisticated types and return things of sophisticated types. Okay? So here's how we're going to fix these things. For one, for this issue, we are going to change our judgment. I told you there's going to be something on the left of the turnstile. And like everybody else, I will use the Greek letter gamma, that is the capital gamma. You can use whatever letter you like, but I have to extend my BNF And what this does is it's just a set, if you will. It's a mapping, it's an environment, it's a heap, but this is all at type checking time. So what it does is it says, I have some sequence of variables, so I can ask a gamma, I can say, what's the type of y? And it'll give me back a type. If there's something in this sequence that is y colon, say, int, then I'll get back int. And if it's not in there, then I really recommend we not use that hack we used in imp where we just returned something arbitrary, like 0 for imp. The whole point here is to not do that because we don't want that program. We want to reject it. Does that make sense? Okay. All right. So it's called a context. I'm sorry. I know we were playing with something an hour ago that was called a context. There's only so many English words. I'll try to call it a type checking environment. You can call whatever you want.
So can you read that in English?
Sure. Assuming the variables in gamma have the types that gamma says they do, E has type tau.
And what's gamma again?
Gamma is a map from variables to types. So in imp, a heap was a map from variables to integers. In lambda, the environments at runtime in our environment-based interpreter was a map from variables to values.
So you're saying if all the variables in an E map to a particular type, then E has that same type?
No, I'm not. So, sorry, these are different taus. Good question. I'm saying, okay, so here's an example of a gamma. It might say X has type int and Y has type int arrow int, a function from int to int, and Z has type int. Okay, that's an example of a gamma. And implicitly in that is, and no other variable is allowed to be used. Okay? And then we might say that some expression, for example, allow me to use I might say Y applied to X has some type. And for example, well, let's see, Y is type int arrow int, and X has type int, so I guess maybe this whole thing has type int.
And you do that because you keep applying that judgment to the Y int arrow int.
Yeah, I mean, in some sense, the rules are on the two slides from now. So,
but if, like, let's say you created a new type called foo.
Uh-huh.
If you had a Q colon foo, mm-hmm. then this judgment would say you can't really say what the type of the expression is going to be.
That's right. If my whole context was just Q has some type, allow me to say int, but you can change it to foo, then this wouldn't be true. I won't be able to derive this, which means the program won't type check, which means I'll reject it.
Okay.
So the whole idea here, I guess, is there's two things going on, I guess. One is I don't want undefined variables. So that's why I don't put everything in my gamma.
Well, I meant assuming that Q is defined, but you just have a new kind of type. If you have mixed types then in your gamma, what can you say about your expression?
Let me jump ahead and maybe this will satisfy. Is I'm going to have a rule that says if I have a variable, I didn't have a typing rule for variables before. Now I'm going to have one. And I'm going to say that the type of X is whatever gamma says it is. And if gamma doesn't say it has a type, then it doesn't have a type.
Okay?
And if it, whatever gamma says. All right. Am I just pushing off the problem to somebody else? Yeah. But that's the right division of responsibility. Is when I go to type check a function body, I'm going to type check that function body under the assumption that X has some type. And I'm going to make it somebody else's problem to tell me what that type is. And every language you use actually has this as well. How do you type check X plus Y? Well, you go and ask, well, what's the type of X and Y where I am? And that's all that gamma is encoding. Okay. Matt.
What is the dot in the for one line?
Oh, that's just for the empty context. Sorry, I'm being a little too formal here. Think of this as a list, and this is empty list, and this is cons. So the comma is cons, and the dot is empty list. And I guess I'm just showing you how people tend to write it. So I need a base case, because if I if every gamma has to be defined in some terms of some smaller gamma, I'll never stop.
So that and isn't part of
No, no, sorry, sorry. I'm making two changes. Good. One thing is I'm adding a new line to my BNF. That's change A. And my second change is I'm changing the form of my judgment. Okay, good. Yep, good. So now I'm going to make a third change. Right. So this was 1A, this was 1B. Those are my first two changes from my wrong attempt. And my third change is I'm going to change the BNF syntax of tau. So it used to be int or function. Now it's going to be int or, and this is the arrow, this is a black arrow. This is the hyphen right angle bracket of ML. This is the, I take this argument and I return this result. And those can be any type you want.
Should there be a... Okay, yeah, okay, come on.
I have some examples, actually, because
yeah.
I think this is a, why is this an infinite number? Why does this BNF define an infinite number of types? Well, here's some examples. Okay, so you might think, oh, well, it defines int arrow int.
Yeah.
But it also defines int arrow int arrow int. Right, because, again, maybe I should rewrite this. I have int or tau arrow tau. Okay. So I can, given an error, I can make any type I want by having an arrow and putting any type I want here and any type I want here. And in abstract syntax terms, this second example is just this tree. Okay? Okay? And you can do this one as well. Okay? And actually, just like in CAML, if I leave off parentheses, they go to the right. And that's, I will try not to leave them off, but you're probably fairly used to this already in CAML. So this is something where ML is very much taking its lead from the work that was done in Lambda Calculus syntactically. But the point is, and this is key, that this does describe an infinite number of types. Basically any tree that has kind of arrows whenever you want and int at the leaves. And if you had more than one base type, if we'd actually started with ints and strings and booleans, then you could have any of those at the leaves. And when we get to it in 10 or 15 slides, we'll add other things to our type language like pairs, which like in CAML will have tau star tau, and then the internal nodes can be stars instead of arrows. And that'll describe pairs, just like in ML. Okay? So this is the sort of slide you can take home and scare your family with. Or the sort of slide that I tend to just give you on the final because I'm not into you memorizing rules. It's a nice summary of basically everything we've done as well as new stuff. So this we have totally done. Okay? These first two lines is our lambda calculus with constants thrown in. And I fixed this once. I've now fixed it again. I bet I fixed it on a different slide.
All right.
Ben tries to proofread these, but I don't know. Yeah, that's definitely my fault. Okay, copy-paste there. Okay, these are the types and contexts as just defined on the previous slide. I just copied them over. This was absolutely on the previous slide. Okay, so it says that a gamma is some list mapping variables to types, and this says that my types are this very simple syntax of trees where you have arrows at the internal nodes and int at the leaves. Okay. This is my dynamic semantics. I like to emphasize it has not changed. That's not what we're doing here. We're defining a new judgment, a type checker, something we run before we run the program, and we do it with these four rules. Okay. All four are repeated on the next slide with some accompanying text. So if it's all right with you, I'll just go to that. All right. This rule says that no matter what your environment is, no matter what variables have what types, C is an integer. 3 has type int regardless of the type of x, y, q, or none of the above. Okay? That sounds good. Variables, I showed this rule before based on your questions. And this is kind of a little, it says, the type of a variable is, and this is just meta syntax, I should actually probably make these parentheses green. Here, I'll. This is just pronounced, and we don't, you know, whatever gamma says. Okay?
So that basically says that if you ever see a variable by itself, it's okay as long as gamma knows that it's been defined.
Exactly. Exactly. And how does gamma know it's been defined? What gamma do we use? Ah, that's the lambda rule, which is the next one we're going to get to. Okay? Actually, I was going to do application first, but since you asked, look at this lambda rule. What it does is when it goes to type check the body, it does it with a bigger gamma. Okay? A gamma that says not only all the variables you used to be allowed to use, but now you're allowed to use X also. Let's ignore for a minute where the hell that tau 1 came from.
Okay. Other point. Variables to the rightmost variable shadows all previous decorations.
Just like an imp, although I guess we wrote it on the left. So it's really unfortunate, actually. But yeah.
Is that X the same X on the bottom? Because
yeah.
They seem like they're slightly different fonts or something.
They are slightly different fonts, but that's my fault. That's the same X. I'm concurring with you that this is Courier New and that's Arial, but I meant for them to be the same. Good. Okay. The function rule is also talked about in the next slide, so just so I can kind of go in order. Let's skip over to the application rule. How am I going to be able to determine that E1 applied to E2 has some type? Call it tau 2. What I need is that E1 is a function that returns a tau 2. Now that makes sense, right? The result of a function application is the result type of the function. Provided that the argument has the same type that the function expects. And as far as the gamma, you don't get to use any, whatever variables you were allowed to use for the application, that's what you're allowed to use for evaluating the thing that will be the function you call and the thing that will be the argument to the function. The body of the actual function, that was type checked somewhere else.
Can I sort of repeat that back to you in different words?
Absolutely.
And you tell me if I'm right.
Mm-hmm.
So the type of the function E1, given the argument E2, will be tau 2 if and only if the type of the function E1 is tau 1 to T2, and the type of the argument E2 is tau 1.
That sounds good.
Is that?
I like that. Here's the interesting thing from a, well, let me say, I agree. I like that a lot. I'm not quibbling at all. Let me just give additional justification for this rule, I guess. This is the rule you've always known and loved. Okay? The result of a function call is the result type of the function you're calling. And the argument type has to be the same as the argument you're expecting. This is what you know and love. It is the same rule. The only thing I guess that's a little weird here is, first of all, there's turnstiles and big fancy green lines. But the other is, no one told us what tau 1 was, so to speak. We just got it by type checking E1. And somehow by type checking E1, we knew what tau 1 was. But that's true, too, in your favorite language. When you write f of x, you don't tell the type checker what the type of f is. It goes and looks it up with the variable rule. And you don't tell it the type of x, it goes and looks it up with the variable rule, and then it checks that they're the same type. Matt?
Is the only place where we build up a bigger gamma
in this rule?
Yeah.
Yes. Because for this language, that's the only way to introduce a variable that you're allowed to use.
Mm-hmm. There's no assignment. It's only function application.
There's no scope. There's no local variables other than lambda. When I add local variables, and we will get to that today, we'll extend the gamma and the type checking rule for that too. But given our language so far, this is the only way to allow the use of variables is to put them under a lambda. And that's the only reason, that's the only rule that extends your gamma. Still a question?
Well, you said that you had to know, like, you find out what tau 1 was by finding out there's a rule that drives tau 2. Don't you just need to know that there's some two types where where they're sort of equivalent, but you don't even know what they are, like in generics or templates or whatever.
Oh, yeah, we will get to fancier type systems. Yeah. So in this world, where all our types are, you know, no type variables, no generics, I mean, they've got to be exactly the same.
Exactly.
But as soon as we have any sort of subtyping or one type is more general than another, you know, alpha is more general than instar int, then yeah. That becomes a much more sophisticated question of does this argument type match what the function expects. Right now, that match question is exact same type, but that's because we're starting simple. Okay. All right. I have some more text on the function rule. So these three rules are just going to disappear from the slide. This is the function rule. I have not changed it. In fact, even the fonts still don't match up. What it does is it says, well, look, I have a lambda. It is going to have a function type. Okay? And its result type is going to be the type of the body. And that's because we don't have like a return keyword. Right? We evaluate the body, we get an answer. That is what's returned. That's where that's coming from. Okay? So far, so good. All right. Now, it's got to be a function type, so I've got to have this arrow. And now I just need an argument type. What type should X have in the body? Well, whatever type I assume is the argument type. Okay? Or let me put it another way. If I want to conclude that lambda x.e takes a tau 1 and returns a tau 2, then when I type check the body, I should assume that x has type tau 1. And now the only screwy thing is that I made up tau 1. I picked one, like int. I asked some oracle, I asked some really smart person, I inferred it. Okay? And if that confuses you or you don't like that, just imagine we changed the syntax. And then we didn't actually write lambda x.e. We made the programmer tell us, oh, like that. And that's what a lot of your favorite languages do. They say, well, I don't feel, the type checker is not smart enough to figure it out, so I will make the programmer explicitly write it down. And then it's much clearer how you should extend gamma and what your argument type is. But from a formal semantic standpoint, I can just say, if you can instantiate this rule such that all the tau 1's match up and the tau 2's and the e's and the x's, then you get to conclude the instantiation. Okay. Questions? Comments? All right. This is a point Ben was kind of making, is I have to be a little careful about what it means to extend a gamma. Okay. There's two ways to think about this. One is that this inner x shadows any of the ones already in gamma, which is the correct behavior. We will have the same behavior when we run. Another is to say you're not allowed to shadow. You say, well, what if I do? What if I do? It's like, well, we still have alpha conversion. We still have the ability to say, oh, you didn't write lambda x.e. You wrote lambda y dot e prime, where e prime is e with all the x's turned into y's. Okay. So you can choose your poison. Okay. Questions? So going back one slide, this is our type system. Going back two slides, this is everything. This is our syntax, our interpreter, and our type checker. And it just all kind of fits together. It's a pretty small language, but it's pretty elegant. Okay? But now we have the big question. This is the question we motivated before we started, which is it sound? Okay? Sometimes when people talk about safety, or talk about soundness, they call it safety. Is it sound? And it turns out it is sound. It has no false positives.
Slides here.
What's that?
We see rule by rule.
We lost the slides on the remote end.
To reconnect their system.
Okay. Well, I can keep talking. It's the outline slide anyway. Nothing fancy to show you. And what we're basically saying is we believe that this type system is sound, meaning that if there is a derivation that an expression has a type, under the empty context, actually, because your initial program is not supposed to have free variables. So that whole gamma was just for type checking under lambdas. But when we start, our context is empty. And I'll show that to you when we get our slides back. If we accept a program, assuming it, no variables, assuming an empty gamma, then no matter how long we run, we won't ever get stuck. And we very laboriously defined what we meant by stuck, that constants were fine and lambdas were fine, but variables were not, and constants applied to things were not, and so on. Okay? How are we doing over there? Still saying, okay. Not good yet. They'll let me know, I'm sure. So, we're going to ask two questions, actually. The hard one is going to be, is it sound? The easy question is going to be, is it complete? And on the next slide, as soon as I'm allowed to show it to you, I'm going to give you an I'm going to show you it's not complete. And that's easy. All I have to do is give you one example. Right? Sound is much harder. There is no notion of example. I have to would have to show you for every program in the world that type checks, it doesn't get stuck. So an example is not going to cut it. Yeah, I can see. I'll give it another minute or two, and then I'll improvise.
Dan, while we're waiting, can I ask you a question?
Please.
Sorry, it kind of goes back a number of slides, but back when you had your sermon, at the bottom you said abstraction, modularity, and encapsulation are impossible because one bad line can have arbitrary global effect. Is that so? You use that to describe why having unsafety in your language was bad. But do you see that as also generalizing to other properties of the language? Like you could say the same thing for programmable class loaders in Java, or aspects and aspect oriented programming, that you can have local changes that affect the global behavior and you can't prove anything anymore.
Yeah, this is a fantastic question. Let's toss in their reflection. Let's toss in security monitors. Let's toss in stack inspection. Even runtime type analysis. I might imagine this is not how most OO languages work, but let's say I had some object and it had some fields I didn't want you to read. Wouldn't it be great if I could cast it to a super type that didn't have those fields, hand it off to you, and know you wouldn't read those fields? Okay. So that's true of all those features, and that's why those features have to be used with care, and in some sense you're trusting the parts of your program that have those features, and if you can't control where those features are used, then you do have that issue. It is not as bad, however. Okay. So what I can do, even in the present, I don't know, maybe with reflection you can get at anything. But the idea is, usually I could create some private data, never share it with anyone, and know that it's not being changed. Whereas with array bounds violations, that's not the case. What I think happens in practice with languages and these features is you end up with what I call an arms race. I'm not the only one, right? So what happens is you build up key abstraction mechanisms so people can't muck with you. Then other people say, oh, we have cross-cutting concerns, we'll invent aspects. And then we'll come up with abstraction mechanisms so people can't use aspects in certain places or only in controlled ways. And then we'll come up with Uber aspects that will be able to violate that and go underneath and change things. And that's called an arms race.
You're back.
I'm back. What a deal. That was a great question, by the way. Not that the others were bad, but it also took the exact right amount of time to answer. Which can't hurt. All right. So, is our type system right? We can define any type system we want. You define a judgment, you write down a pile of rules, you turn it into Ben, he gives you an 84. Right?
That made my job easy.
So what we'd like to do is show that it has the properties we want, and I will demonstrate, at least at a high level, that it is sound, and yet it is incomplete. Okay? So I can, as I mentioned when we didn't have the slides, I can show incompleteness with one example. Okay? Here is the example. Okay? This program cannot type check. Okay, let me show you that first. The reason why I can't type check is I have to type check this function body, and while I type check it, I have to choose some gamma where x maps to some type. And I have to pick a single type in this language. In fancier languages, I could pick some very fancy type. But in this language, given the type language I have to pick a single one. And no matter what I pick, I'm in trouble. Because this call right here says, well, x better have the form int arrow something, because it takes an int. And this application over here is only going to work if x is something that takes a function, because I'm passing it a function. And you can't have it both ways. Our function rule was too restrictive. It said you have to pick a single type for x. Okay, so it just isn't going to type check. Well, that's only half of what you have to show incompleteness. You also have to show this program won't get stuck. I could have actually just finished the program here and said, well, I'm already a value, I don't get stuck. So I do something a little more interesting than that. You can plug this into the 8,000 interpreters I've provided for you, and you'll get 3. Okay? So that is our proof of incompleteness. That's all we have to do. Soundness is much more interesting. So first, let's just state the theorem. Let's just at least state it. Okay? Here's what it says, using all our fancy symbols. It says, if you type check, and you, under an empty gamma, meaning your top-level program is not allowed to have any free variables, all your variables have to be inside of functions, and you run for a while, then wherever you get, E2, either you've already terminated, or you can take one more step. Okay? That's just definition expanding. We said soundness means if you type check, you'll never get stuck. This is how we write you type check, and this is how we write you never get stuck. Okay? So that's just definition expanding. Okay? The proof, if we actually went into all the details, would take us about an hour and a half. But all that I'd really like to emphasize to you, and we'll have plenty of time to do this today, is that if you break it up into the right two pieces, it works just fine. And these pieces are so common now in programming languages and reasoning about type systems that they have names. They're called progress and preservation. Here's what they say. Progress says, if you type check, you're not stuck yet. Let me expand that for you. If you type check, well, you can be a value, that's fine. But otherwise, you can take one step. Okay, that's all progress says. It says if you type check, you might get stuck someday, but you're not stuck now. Okay? There's some function application you can do. Preservation says if you type check and you take a step, you still type check. Ah, massive typo on the slide. E prime.
Is it also significant that you're type checking to the same type?
Yes, and I was about to say it. It's absolutely crucial. We don't care from a definition standpoint, but if you go to push through the proof, this is key. Because think about our dynamic semantics. We have some E1 applied to E2. You're going to go and take a step here, and then you're going to have to make the whole thing still type check. You're going to need that it's the same type. Yeah. So what we're noticing here is that this tau and this tau are the same. This E and this E are the same, and this E prime and this E prime are the same. And what that says is, it does actually say, and I did not pronounce this in English, if you type check and you take a step, you type check and have the same type. Okay? And that is important. So let's actually see how these go together. Because this is about as mathy as we'll get in the class, but I think it's worth it. Okay? So again, what we want to prove is that is this guy. I've switched to there exists. You just pronounce backwards E, there exists. And this is just so I could have some room on the slide because I did not know about this super cool thing. Okay. And it says, if you type check and you run for a while, then you're not stuck. That's our theorem. And this is what we get to assume. Okay, we get to assume preservation. That's this guy. And we get to assume progress. That's this guy. Okay. And what we're going to do is, we are not going to prove this exactly. We're going to prove something a little bit stronger. We're going to add right here, and E2 has type tau.
This is same tau as the first one.
Same tau as this one, absolutely. This is very, very common. We're about to do a proof by induction on how long you've run. And it's very common that you state what you actually want. That's this guy. All right, you state what you actually want, and that's too hard to prove by induction. You have to, this is called strengthening your induction hypothesis. You're going to have to actually prove something stronger. Okay, and that's exactly what we're doing. I'm kind of showing you the key part. You add that little bit there. Okay. So now all we have to do is show this, and we're going to do it by induction. Induction on what? Well, I'm kind of hiding a number somewhere. The number I'm hiding is under this asterisk. Okay. What I said is E steps to E2 in some number of steps. Okay. That means there's some N that it gets to E2 in N steps. And I'm going to do induction on that N. How many steps it took to get from E to E2. Okay? So, like any inductive proof over numbers N, you have a base case and you have inductive cases. So the base case is you get to E2 in zero steps. Okay? So if I get to E2 in zero steps, that means E and E2 are the same program. Base cases are always degenerate. Okay? Now, they're the same program. So this part, if E has type tau, then E2 has to have type tau. I'm done with that. All I need is that I can get to some E3. Right? And that's right here. I get to assume, I'm assuming for this proof, that if I type check, oh no, number one, sorry. If I type check, then I can take a step. So that's what this means. This means immediate from progress, that basically, as long as E and E2 are the same term, this guy, which is called progress, is exactly what we're trying to prove. But that's not always the case. That's only the case when N equals 0. When N is greater than 0, well, this is kind of interesting. That means there's some E2 prime such that I can go to E2 prime in n minus 1 steps. And E2 prime can step to E2. It's the only way that I could possibly get from E to E2 in n steps is if there's some E2 prime that I got to in n minus 1 steps. Just breaking it up. Right? Well, now I get to use induction. I got n minus 1. I get to assume my theorem. And what that theorem tells me, basically, is that E2 prime has type tau. And you know what? I have this. And I have this. And I have this. Two boxes plus one oval equals E2 has type tau. And that plus this, this was step was because of preservation. And then given that and progress, I'm not stuck. I.e., whatever progress says. Either E2 is a value or there exists some E prime such that E2 can go to E prime. Matt?
I think I'm confusing myself. When you have the arrow with the star and you're calling it run for a while, you mean in our small step interpreter or some interpreter period?
Yeah, I mean our small step interpreter where each step is one full derivation in the small step interpreter. So yeah, it's how many times around the loop that calls interp small one.
So you're sort of assuming that you're allowed to call the interpreter before you know that you're allowed to call the interpreter because you haven't type checked it yet. But in the process of type checking it, you're allowed to use the small step interpreter.
Okay, good, huge point. This is just, I'm just stating a theorem. My type checker, let me go back here. Good. My type checker has four rules. Here they are. 1, 2, 3, 4. None of them call the interpreter. Okay? And here's my interpreter. It has three rules for interp small one, and none of them call the type checker. Okay? So that's hugely important. And then what I want to do is I want to prove type soundness. Now the statement of type soundness mentions both. It says if you type check, and then you run for a while, and those are two separate algorithms. You type check and then you run for a while, you're not stuck. Okay, good. Great clarification, especially at 9/11. Questions?
All right. I think you also need an E prime on preservation at the end.
Here, I just copy paste there.
Yeah.
Yeah, good. Yeah. By the way, it's up to me after lecturing for 3 hours to go home and try to remember what these typos were. Because as much as you guys probably don't like listening to me, I can't stand listening to me. Like, I will not watch the lecture and find all these typos again. Like, either I remember them or I won't. But I'll try to remember them. Okay. All right. So what's the point here? Okay, this was an inductive proof, and for those of you who like inductive proofs, this is actually a very elegant one. For those of you who don't like inductive proofs, it's still a very elegant one. And I'd like to say without numbers and Greek letters what it's saying. Okay. Progress is what we care about. Okay, we decided when we started on this types adventure an hour ago that what we cared about was not getting stuck. Okay? So really all we care about is progress. But you can't prove progress, you can't extend it to I run for progress, the little helper theorem. Progress, the helper theorem, just says I'm not stuck right now. What we actually care about is, and I'll never get stuck. Okay? Preservation is the invariant that holds no longer how long we've been running. As you run your program, programs obey invariants. Right? Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. But one invariant that our programs preserve, that's why it's called preservation, is their type. You have a program, before you started running it, it had some type, and the invariant is, no matter how many steps you take, it still has that type. Then we have this little thing called progress that says whenever the invariant holds, you can take a step. You put those together, and you'll never get stuck. Let me try to say it one more way. What we're trying to do is show you don't get to a bad place. Right? A bad place is a stuck position. Okay? And we basically have two helper theorems. One says, if the invariant holds, you're in a good place. So you can go somewhere. And that somewhere is a good place. If you put those together, you're never going to get to a bad place.
Invariant sounds like you can't change your type.
That's right.
While you're running.
That's right.
But that's not a very interesting program.
Sub-expressions, you change what term you are. You have 3 plus 4 and you become 7. But 3 plus 4 had type int and so does 7.
But if you have a lambda that takes one type and returns another,
uh-huh. Then if I apply it,
you break, then this doesn't hold anymore.
Oh, no, it does. This is a great question. So it takes an int and returns a string. I'll add strings for the sake of the example. Okay. And I apply it to 3. Okay? So this whole program will have type int. And the reason is, string. And the reason is that this has type int arrow string. And this has type int. And I have an application rule that says, therefore, the whole thing has the result type. I take a step. I substitute 3 for all the x's, I become high.
So what you're saying is like if you take a program tree,
mm-hmm.
as long as that whole tree goes mm-hmm. to one type, you mm-hmm. can take a step and it'll still go to the same type, mm-hmm. you're not stuck.
Yep. I mean, the definition of not stuck is just I can go to something. But the way I proved I'll never get stuck is by proving the stronger thing, which is my type always stays the same.
Oh, add one thing, I guess, just mm-hmm. as an example. If you write a very careful C program and you don't do screwy things with casts, your type is int arrow car star star arrow int. Always. That's the type of main.
Yep.
But you can do anything you want as long as it's type safe. And the result of your program is just the return, the exit code at the end of it. But you've done all this interesting computation in the middle. So where all the power comes from is what you're doing in the middle, and you're making sure that all those intermediate steps are right.
Good. Matt?
You have a typo, I think, in the second bullet. You said longer, and you mean matter?
Yes.
It holds no... holds no longer how long... Oh! You know, Ben actually told me that one, and I looked at it, and I was like, oh, no, Ben just misread it. It's right. I see now. Okay. Weird. Ben actually found that one. Okay.
Didn't type check.
No, I didn't type check at all. All right. I'm going to breeze over this. For people who are more interested in formal programming language semantics, of course, there are those two helper theorems. Right, this is what I'm skipping. How the heck do you prove those? I just wanted, I could walk you through it. I can point you to nice tutorials on it. But just to point out, it's not like we proved soundness, right? We assumed two really big lemmas. One are theorems, helper theorems, lemmas, same thing. One is progress. And the idea is, let me just give you the very high idea, is that, okay, so I have this, and I have to show I can take one step or be a value. It's actually not that hard. There's only four kinds of expressions. Okay? So if I'm a constant, I'm a value. If I'm a lambda, I'm a value. If I'm a variable, I didn't type check. There's no way a variable can type check under the empty gamma. So it holds vacuously, for those of you who like math. The only remaining possibility is that it's an application. And now there's three subcases. I know I'm going fast. Maybe the left thing's not a value, in which case, inductively, it'll be able to take a step. It's a smaller expression. Maybe it is a value. Maybe the right thing's not a value, in which case, it'll be able to take a step. Inductively, it's a smaller expression. The only other possibility is they're both values. And now I have to be really worried that E1 might be a constant, and E2 might be a lambda, or another constant. But E1 can't be a constant, because it type checks. So I can take a step. It has to be a lambda, that's the only other possibility, and therefore, I'll be able to go somewhere. That's all I have to show for progress. Preservation. Now I'm assuming I took a step. I've just divided it, and now I have to show I get the exact same type again of E prime. You can tell that Dan copies and pastes. Right. Again, we have to do this by induction. We have to talk about smaller expressions and smaller typing derivations. Turns out the tough one, the really tough one, is when you get to do substitution. So what happens is you started out with some lambda x dot e, and you applied that to some v, and after that step, you got e with v substituted for x. Well, what I know beforehand, if you actually assume that this type checks, then I know that assuming x has the right type, e has this, and I know that this v has the right type. But I have to know that after I go and do this complicated substitution, I still have something of the right type. And that requires its own inductive argument. And this is called the substitution lemma, and I've spent a ridiculous portion of my life proving substitution lemmas. I think my PhD advisor said, you know, one of us is going to have on our tombstone just one more substitution lemma. They're never very exciting, but you do have to prove them a lot. So that's your high overview, and I'm happy to give people pointers. The key idea, and the thing I did want you to get, is, you know, this what's the point of, you know, preservation is about this invariant that says you're not, you know, you stay in good places, and progress is about good places aren't stuck. Okay? So this is where we are. We have our simply typed language. It fit on a slide. We've argued at a very high level why it's sound. I gave you a completely compelling example that it's incomplete. And what we've now done is laid the groundwork to take this language and in a matter of just a few minutes, okay, it'll take a little longer than that, make it a much, much more powerful language. Let me give you, in 1 minute, a precursor of how we're going to do this. Okay? So we have this tiny language. We used a whole lot of heavy machinery, heavy mathematics to define it. But now we're going to add a lot of things, and we're not going to add any new fancy mathematics. We have all the sort of meta language we need, okay? And that'll make let us add pairs, booleans, data types, recursion, all very quickly. And as we do it, there's going to be a form to what we're doing. And that form is, we're going to add new syntax to our language. We're going to add new inference rules, new cases to our interpreter for dealing with that syntax. and new typing rules for type checking that syntax. Right? We add that three part to our language. If we add something new, we have to affect all three parts. And in particular, there's even more structure to what we're going to do. That is, every time we add a new kind of type, we're going to add new values that have that type. Right now, we have lambdas and their value. We have arrows and their values are lambdas. We have integers and their values are constants. We're going to have new ways to make values. Those are called introduction forms. And they'll get a little more interesting than what we've seen. And we'll have new ways to use the values, and those are called elimination forms. So for arrow types, the introduction form is lambda, and the elimination form is application. For constants, the introduction for int, the introduction form is constants, and because I was lazy, we don't have any elimination forms. If we had something like plus, that would be an elimination form. I'm happy to stick around for questions, but it's 9:22. We'll pick up next week.